This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Tom Striegler in the Special Collections Library, Lubbock, Texas, on the 1st of August, year 2000, at approximately 10:50 a.m. Mr. Striegler, would you please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Sure. Tom Striegler, I was born in Dallas, Texas. My parents were Harvey Striegler, originally from Fredericksburg, Texas, and Mary Elizabeth Miller Striegler, originally born in Amarillo, but raised primarily in Dallas. At the time of my birth, my parents lived in Irving, and I was raised in Irving and lived in Irving up until the time I went to college. I graduated from Irving High School, attended Texas A&M, beginning in 1961 and graduating in January of 1966. Had a degree, or attained a degree in wildlife management, and was commissioned a second lieutenant in the regular army upon graduation from A&M, which, in case anybody reading this doesn't know at the time, was all male military as opposed to the university that it is today. Following graduation from Texas A&M, while working at A&M, majoring in wildlife management, I got a summer job with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, which turned out to be a permanent full-time position, unbeknownst to me at the time. So I spent summers in college working for the Fish and Wildlife Service in several areas around the country. Once I graduated, I went immediately to work with the Fish and Wildlife Service in Oklahoma for about 3 months, awaiting a call to active duty in the United States Army. I entered active duty on 28 April 1966 at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, in field artillery. Spent 8 weeks as a field artillery basic school, followed by 3 weeks in airborne school, and then was assigned to the 9th Infantry Division, which had been reactivated at Fort Riley, Kansas, and was training for deployment to Vietnam. Spent 4 years on active duty in the Army, with a tour in Vietnam and a tour in Korea, and also a tour as an instructor at the artillery school in Fort Sill. Following release from active duty in 1970, I went back to work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Yuma, Arizona, as an assistant refuge manager on the National Wildlife Refuge. In 1972, I transferred to Houston, Texas as a special agent with the Division of Law Enforcement for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And for the rest of my career, worked as a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, ultimately retiring as chief of law enforcement in 1998, and then moving to Fredericksburg, Texas, where I now reside as an unemployed individual.
Okay.
We'll go from here.
Okay, let's go ahead and discuss briefly some of your reasons for entering Texas A&M. Why did you choose that school in particular?
Well, partly family tradition. My father graduated from Texas A&M in 1930. My mother graduated from SMU. Mm-hmm. But Texas A&M and the military tradition of Texas A&M always held a fascination for me. And while there was no pressure put on me by the family to go there, it just always seemed like the place I wanted to go. There was never any question in my mind from my earliest days that I was going to go to Texas A&M. And a large part of that had to do with military tradition. As I say, at that time, A&M was all male military, so at least for the first 2 years, everybody was in the Corps of Cadets. I had fully intended. I was raised in the tradition of the generation of World War II that we owed service to our country. Of course, in the 50s and 60s, we had the universal draft where everybody was going to be drafted, and as my mother used to say, if you're going to be in the Army, you might be an officer. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, there was a tradition in the family of military service, going back to relatives who served in the Civil War. My grandfather served in the Spanish-American War. My father was in World War II and the Korean War. So there was a long history of military service in the family, and Texas A&M seemed like a good way to continue that tradition.
Okay. with regard to the training, the ROTC training at Texas A&M, what was, do you recall much of it? What was good about it? What was lacking?
I recall quite a bit of it. A&M was, as I say, a military school, so we lived in dormitories by companies, by battalions, a military organization. We were in uniform 24 hours a day. It was very similar, I suppose, to Citadel, VMI, West Point, service academies. In fact, as an aside, a little known fact is that Texas A&M's provided more officers to World War II than any other school in the country, including the military academies. So A&M had a strong military position, and the training, the ROTC training, was pretty much standard ROTC training that you would receive, except that it continued beyond the classroom to the extent that you spent, as I said, 24 hours a day in uniform in a military atmosphere. In addition, at A&M, as opposed to most ROTC schools, the training was, I think, more intensive. We certainly, in our junior year, engaged in a lot more field-type training, tactics, small unit tactics training, that other ROTC units did not provide at other colleges. And that became very evident that preparation, how important it was, when we got to ROTC summer camp between my junior and senior year, because those of us from A&M had already had much, if not all, of the summer camp training. That so it was much easier to excel at summer camp because we'd already been there. Certainly we hadn't fired the heavy weapons like the machine guns and the mortars and things like that, but as far as small unit tactics, platoon level tactics, familiarity with the M1 rifle, which was what we trained with at that time, the .45 pistol and those sorts of things, we were clearly ahead of most of the other folks at summer camp. So I think the level of training at A&M was superior to most other ROTC units. And once I got in the Army and served with West Point graduates, I felt the training that we had received was comparable to the training that West Point graduates had.
Okay. In your decision to continue with the ROTC, you said that everybody at Texas A&M was required to take at least the first 2 years, and then I guess the second 2 years were voluntary.
That's correct. At the end of your sophomore year, your military record, military science record was reviewed, and assuming you had passing grades, you were offered what's called a contract to complete the next 2 years. And basically, the contract, upon successful completion, you were commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army or Air Force, depending upon which branch you chose. In addition, you were paid a small stipend. I think the first year I received $27 a month for the 9 months of school. The second year, they doubled that, so we actually got $54 a month and thought we were wealthy at the time. But the decision to pursue a contract was not something that I had to deal with at the time, because I went into A&M with the intent of pursuing a commission in the Army. So the fact the second 2 years were voluntary really made no difference to me. That was what I wanted to do, and seriously was considering a military career at the time. So obviously the way to start that would be to go ahead and get the commission. So it wasn't really a decision that I'm not sure I ever consciously made it. It was just something I always knew I was going to do.
Okay. And the trainers that you actually had at Texas A&M, the officers and the NCO personnel that were training you, what was your opinion of them? What did you think of the training that you received?
Well, I thought the training was excellent. I thought the officers and the NCOs that were in the military science department at the time were excellent. I don't recall any of them being what I considered bad officers, either then or later having more experience in the military. I always have been able to look back on the officers that were in the military science department at A&M at that time and thought that they were some of the better officers that I knew in the military. So,
what was the size of Texas A&M at the time you were there?
At the time I was there, it was between 6,000 and 8,000 students total, of which more than half of that were in the Corps cadets. So the college was much smaller than it is now. Now it's 40-something thousand students. And the Corps cadets was probably twice the size it is now. I think now it's around 2,500 as compared to it. We were running around 5,000 students in the Corps cadets at the time, I believe.
Now, you graduated in I guess, the spring of 1965.
Well, actually, I graduated in January of 1966.
Okay.
I managed to compress my 4 years of college into 4.5.
Okay.
Result of changing majors and minors too many times.
Okay. I see. When you graduated January 66, by that time we had experienced the Gulf of Tonkin incident in Vietnam and off the coast of Vietnam, and had President Johnson had committed American ground forces to Vietnam. How much were those events discussed at Texas A&M amongst the Corps cadets and amongst the cadre that were training you?
Oh, well, amongst the cadre, well, let's take the Corps cadets first. It was discussed, you might want to say ad nauseum, endlessly, because most of us in the Corps, at least the upperclassmen, knew we were going to be commissioned. We assumed that we would soon be in Vietnam, so that it was foremost in our minds throughout our particularly our senior year, first combat troop, but even prior to that, because there were advisors over there prior to that, and involvement in Vietnam, even beginning in my sophomore year and through my junior year, the escalation, we were well aware that there was a good possibility that at least some of us could end up as advisors in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in the summer of 65, spring and summer of 65, when combat troops were actually committed, then those of us who were around the fall of 66 knew very well that we were probably going to be headed for Vietnam. So it was, as I say, it was foremost of a discussion. Now among the cadre, and we did ask the cadre, the ROTC officers, about it, but none of them had been, because they were much like us. We had one officer, one major, as I recall, who had been in combat in Korea. The rest of the officers we had come on active duty subsequent to Korea, but prior to Vietnam, and so none of them had any combat experience. So they, while we would ask questions, they really didn't have too many answers for us, and admittedly they didn't, because they just had not been there. I do recall they brought in an officer who had returned from Vietnam, and I don't know whether they found him at one of the local military bases or what, to talk to us about it. And I do recall he gave about a 2-hour lecture on what it was like to be in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly Vietnam was foremost in our thoughts at the time, because we all assumed we would be over there. And I think most of us were.
Do you recall much what that officer talked about in that presentation, or...?
Not a whole lot. The one thing I remember him saying, because I do remember him talking about the amount of weight he lost. He was an advisor to the South Vietnamese Army. And I remember him saying that he went from something like 175 or 180 pounds down to about 135 or 40 pounds in the year he was there. And I remember him talking about what it was like to walk through the rice paddies. And he described it as walking upstairs all day long. That it was just exhausting to walk through the flooded rice paddies all day.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I don't really recall a whole lot of what he had to say.
Okay. And in your ROTC training, how much did they talk about the different kinds of warfare? I mean, conventional versus unconventional, counterinsurgency, things of that nature.
Well, during the early 60s, of course, we were in the midst of the Cold War, and the entire focus was on Europe, warfare with the Soviet bloc in Europe, another either nuclear or conventional World War II type conflict. So most of our training was directed towards that end. It wasn't until probably my senior year that they began to provide some instruction and information about counterinsurgency type warfare. That, however, was very limited because none of the instructors had any experience with it. The Army had not really created much doctrine towards that type of warfare. And so, for the most part, not only at Texas A&M, but even when I got to Fort Sill as a second lieutenant taking field artillery officer's basic course, the training was still directed toward the European type warfare, the European style of World War II type of warfare, as opposed to Vietnam. We got some limited orientation into changes we might see in Vietnam, but for the most part it was still directed at the conventional World War II type situation.
Okay. Did that change much from going from ROTC to the active duty military schools, officer basic course, and then your advanced training as a field artillery officer, field artillery basic course?
No, because once again, by the time I got into field artillery basic course, it was spring of 1966. Army combat troops had still only been in Vietnam really less than a year, because most of them didn't go until the summer of 65. So you didn't have people who'd come back, and the Army had not yet adjusted its training doctrine to take into account. We did learn a few things, the different deployment in artillery there versus the World War II situation. But we never practiced it in the field. What we did in the field was still very much the World War II type of situation. So it wasn't until, now let me jump forward a year or so. By the time I got back to Fort Sill as an instructor in the artillery school in early 68, that had completely changed, and what we were then teaching was Vietnam-type artillery tactics, Vietnam-type conflict. So it took a year. You had to get the people over there, get them back, and get those people into the system of training before the Army was really able to make that adjustment. And I don't think anybody can fault the Army for that, because I think they were still learning over in Vietnam. Yeah. It was just a timing situation.
Mm-hmm. But knowing, I mean, you had a strong feeling that you'd be going to Vietnam.
Oh yeah, well, it's if I can jump aside to a little anecdote one of my daughters has spent most of her life lecturing me about various and sundry things. And which I always found more than amusing. Mm-hmm. But one of the lectures I got was shortly before she graduated from college, she decided to start lecturing me with how much harder she had it graduating college than I did. And so I listened to her for a half hour, 45 minutes, and finally realized that her primary concern was that, okay, here she's got to graduate from college, suddenly she's got to go out and find a job. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, Marty, I will concede that you had it a lot rougher getting out of college than I did. I said, because in one day, I got my Bachelor of Science degree in Wildlife Management from Texas A&M. I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army, and I received orders for active duty to going to Vietnam. My initial orders to active duty assigned me to the 4th Infantry Division, parentheses, for ultimate assignment to Vietnam on or about January 1967. So, okay. Yes, before I ever entered active duty, I knew I was going to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Now, those orders were subsequently changed, and I was reassigned to the 9th Infantry Division, and there they were a little more circumspect. It was parentheses for ultimate assignment to Southeast Asia on or about January 67, but that doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out where that's going to be.
Right.
So, yes, by the time I was on active duty, I was already on orders to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So,
well, knowing that you were going to Vietnam and receiving a certain amount of classroom training in field artillery tactics and deployment that would be relevant to the experience of Vietnam, What did you think when you ultimately went to the field but weren't able to practice that?
Well, I guess I didn't really think that much about it. I mean, I understood, and because we did ask, and you know, what are the differences? And the instructors, to the best of their ability, tried to deal with it, but they had not been there either. Again, we were less than a year into combat troops being in Vietnam. There had not been a rotation back of core career military officers. So there was nobody who had that experience, other than maybe someone who had been over there earlier as an advisor, and that's a little bit different situation. And as it turns out, there were some differences, but we were still, and we can get into those later, but we were still, the bottom line is, you had to compute the data in the fire direction center, you had to transmit that data to the guns, you had to get that data on the guns, and you had to get that round or round on the target. That didn't change. That basic concept of how you shoot artillery and how you got the artillery on the target never changed from, and hasn't changed from World War II to the present day. Mm-hmm. Now, to some extent you can say that's not quite true, because we were doing it all manually with firing charts and slide rules, and today one computer talks to another computer and there's virtually no human intervention, which scares me to death when I think about it. But the basic principle is still the same. So what was really was changed was not so much the basics that we were learning in officer basic school. What really was the difference were things such as firing 360 degrees. In World War II, the enemy was out there, you had a front line, your guns were pointed towards the enemy, and you had a zone of fire that you didn't fire beyond this direction to the right or this direction to the left, and that was your area of fire, and all your fire went out that direction. In Vietnam, you were stuck in the middle with infantry operating 360 degrees around you, and you were subject to be firing in not only any direction on the compass at any point in time, but literally firing 2-3 fire missions out of one battery in several directions. At least one situation, or more than one situation, I can recall where I would be firing 3 different fire missions in 3 different directions in support of 3 different firefights going on around us. So that's the kind of thing. The other thing that drastically changed in Vietnam, that never changed, that we were not taught, was splitting, well, first of all, splitting of an artillery battalion into individual batteries. That just didn't occur. In World War II, all fire direction information, all firing data was computed by the battalion fire direction center, sent down to the individual batteries. The batteries put on the guns and fired it. In Vietnam, we were operated as independent, separate batteries. Battalion really was just a logistical support more than anything else. We computed all our own firing data. Fire missions were called directly into the battery fire direction center. We computed our own firing data and fired our own fire missions. As a battery executive officer, I not only operated as commander of the firing battery, but I essentially operated as the operations officer in battalion would function as a fire direction control officer for the battery. The other thing that happened in Vietnam is not only did we split up into independent batteries, but many times we would split the battery where I would take a platoon of 2 guns or 2 platoons of 4 guns out separate from the battery so that the infantry would be going beyond our firing range. So we would take part of the battery out and operate as a split battery so that I would have to be firing several miles away with half the fire direction center, and I would be the only officer firing in support of part of the infantry while the rest of the battery was back maybe at the fire base supporting the rest of the infantry. So those kinds of things were virtually unheard of. Again, in getting back into history a little bit, in World War II, just prior to the Battle of Bulge, there were a couple of artillery battalions that, because of the front through the Ardennes was spread so thin, they actually had to split the battalion up and have some of the batteries separated from the battalion. And that was virtually unheard of in World War II. In Vietnam, that was common practice. That was standard practice. And even splitting the battery into separate segments was not uncommon in Vietnam. So those were the kinds of adjustments that we had to make, as opposed to the kinds of things that were taught in basic, because field artillery officer basic was designed to teach us how do you compute the firing data, the types of rounds you have, what types of fire you put on what types of targets, how do you actually fire the guns, you know, that type of basic information. That did not change even with all of the differences in Vietnam. So the training in officer basic was still relevant. Mm-hmm. It's just we took that and moved far beyond it in certain areas once we got into country.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there what was the most difficult part of that training for you? Artillery basic.
Probably the most difficult for me, and I won't. I can probably look at my scores. I think I've still got my scores in here and tell you exactly. Gunnery was, I think, the most difficult for me. And I think that was mostly because it wasn't something that interested me that much. And I'm not sure why, but it was basic mathematics, which I've always been good at, but have never been that interested in mathematics. So it wasn't so much that the gunnery was that difficult. I just didn't have interest in it, therefore I didn't study it as much as I did other things. I much preferred being out on the hill as a forward observer, calling the fire, mm-hmm. as opposed to being back at the battery, calculating the data to hit the target. That was much more enjoyable and much, in my opinion, much easier.
And as a forward observer, how much control did you have over the battery fires in terms of the types of rounds that are being used? I mean, when you called in a mission in Vietnam, did you just ask for whatever fire they could provide, or would you ask for a particular type of munition?
Well, in Vietnam, and you have to understand that I only spent a couple of weeks actually as forward observer. Mm-hmm. And during that period, we had very little action. It was during a Tet ceasefire, we had some sniper fire, but there was no serious action, and mostly what I called in were just defensive concentrations, and I think I called a couple of fire missions in on sniper fire suppression, but nothing of any significance. However, as a battery executive officer and commanding the firing battery and being responsible for the rounds that went out, I had a working relationship with the forward observers, and I just let them know that it was primarily their call. They were the people on the ground. Mm-hmm. You tell me what you need, and mm-hmm. we'll do our best to provide it.
Cool.
I do not remember a single incident where I overruled the forward observer on the fire he requested, as long as we were able to provide that fire. It just never made sense to me to try and second guess them. They were the ones out there getting shot at.
Right. Okay. Now you went from the field artillery basic course to airborne training at Fort Benning.
Went to airborne training at Fort Benning, yes.
And, I guess before we talk about airborne training, was there anything else you wanted to discuss about field artillery basic?
It was pretty straightforward. Basically, we learned the basics of being a second lieutenant and junior officer in artillery. It was an exciting time because it was new. It was very interesting. But there was not anything that really stood out in my mind through that. It was just, to me, it was a period that had to be endured in order to get on with the real work.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is, I guess, kind of the way I've always viewed training and education. It was, even college, to me, was just a period to be endured so I could get out in the real world and work. And I know a lot of folks, most of my kids, like education for its own sake. A couple of them would be professional students if they had somebody to support them, but unfortunately, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that was never the way I looked at education. Right? It was a means to an end to me, and I viewed officer basic as the same light, which is probably reflected in my grades all the way through.
Okay. The the transition to airborne school. What, first of all, why did they send you to airborne school if they knew you were going to the 9th ID?
Well, because while I was at field artillery officer, well, let me back up. When I graduated from Texas A&M, I graduated as a distinguished military graduate and was offered a regular Army commission, which I accepted. However, it took a while for the paperwork to be processed. That has to be approved by Congress. So I actually went on active duty as a reserve officer. And then it was about halfway through officer's basic that my regular Army commission came through. Now, what happens then, happened then, I don't know if it's still correct, but at that point, if you accepted a regular Army commission, you had or were required to attend either airborne school or ranger training. I took a look at it, and it was 3 weeks of airborne school and 9 weeks of ranger training, and to me that was a no-brainer. I chose airborne school. It always seemed to, also, chasing snakes in the Everglades seemed a lot more exciting to me than jumping out of, or less exciting to me, I should say, than jumping out of airplanes. I was a wildlife manager, management major at A&M. I'd already chased snakes, so I knew what that was all about. So the reason I went to airborne school, primarily, one, I wanted to, but it was required, so I didn't have any trouble getting in. At any rate, once I graduated from field artillery basic, then it was, I think I had a couple of weeks in between, and then reported to airborne school at Fort Benning. And that was basically your standard 3 weeks airborne school. The first week was what they call ground week, second week tower week, and third week you jumped out of airplanes. And, and I did my 5 jumps, and that's the last time I've seen a parachute since. So,
how did you enjoy that?
I enjoyed it. Being young and naive and stupid, you know, it was physically challenging, but not impossible. Obviously, being a second lieutenant had some advantages. The cadre didn't cut you a whole lot of slack, but they did treat you with a little more dignity than the private E-nothings were treated. The actual jumping out of the airplane, I guess that's where I've always been impressed with military, with Army training, let me put it that way. I was impressed with the quality of training at A&M. I was impressed even more so with the quality of training at Fort Sill at the Artillery Basic School. But I think Airborne School was the one where I really was probably the most impressed with the training there, because what they did, and I assume it was intentional, but they, from the day one, they began teaching you that when somebody said jump, you, even if you were just standing around, you immediately went through the motions of jumping out the door of an airplane and into your into the position. So you went through 2 weeks of that training of many times a day somebody come up and saying jump, and you jumped. So by the time you got to the door of that airplane and somebody said jump, you were out the door before you ever realized what you'd done, and it was too late to climb back in. The other thing I think that I contend was a psychological point on the part of the Army is that they brought in a bunch of Air Force Reserve pilots with the old C-119s, the old flying boxcars that have the two booms back for us to jump out of. And if you've ever flown in one of those things, if you've ever taken off in one of those things, there is no way you would ever want to land it. So you were more than happy to jump out the door of that airplane.
Is that what you primarily jumped out of?
That was the only thing I ever
That's the only thing we jumped out of. Wow.
In fact, those things rattled so bad that you could never tell when the wheels left the runway. It wasn't any smoother once you got in the air than when you were rolling down the runway. I was very happy to jump out of the airplane.
Okay. So you left there and went on to went back to Fort Sill.
No. I left Fort Benning and went directly to Fort Riley, Kansas.
Oh, Fort Riley. I'm sorry.
Where the 9th Division had been activated that spring. And I arrived at Fort Riley on August 1st of 1966. The 9th Division had actually been activated in the spring and had received 15,000 draftees from the reception center, still in civilian clothes. And they took those 15,000 draftees through basic training within the 9th Division, which was the first time that had been done since World War II. I arrived shortly after the end of basic training, so that they were at that point in what they call advanced individual training, and was assigned as a forward observer with a battery of the 2nd Battalion, 4th Field Artillery. And we went through advanced individual training, then through basic and advanced unit training. And from 1st of August, when we, I think, had just started, they probably just started advanced individual training, till we went through full combat evaluation prior to Thanksgiving, was the shortest period, I believe, a division has been from activation to combat in the history of the Army. In fact, I read recently that the training cycle was compressed by something like 12 weeks, I believe, in order to tie in the arrival of the division in Vietnam with the dry season, so that we wouldn't be going in during the middle of the rainy season.
Besides the artillery training you had received up to that point, what kind of individual weapons training did you have?
Well, of course, going all the way back to ROTC, in ROTC we received both rifle and pistol training. Mm-hmm. At ROTC summer camp, we actually also received some very basic machine gun training, some basic mortar training, i.e., here's how you drop the round in the tube type of thing. Mm-hmm. Then, and I guess we did receive hand grenade training at ROTC summer camp. Mm-hmm. Then, in field artillery basic, we again received basic small arms training, rifle training, machine gun training, grenade training, that your basic defensive weapons, individual weapons training. Although most of the training was designed to fire artillery. We did go through, I do remember it in artillery, at Fort Sill, in artillery basic, going through a combat, live fire combat, almost like an obstacle course type of a training, where you would run down the lane, and it was live fire, you had live weapons in, and they had pop-up targets, so that you would run down, there were three or four of you on the line, and there would be targets pop up, and you'd have to fire those. We did go through that type of small unit training. Mm-hmm. We also went through a lot of map reading training, a lot of ground navigational training, because certainly in the artillery, if you don't know where you are, it gets very dangerous to start calling in artillery fire. So map reading was an extremely important course there. Once I got to Fort Riley with the 2nd and the 4th, again, we still went through the basic small arms training. We took our folks through machine gun training, both M60 and 50 caliber machine gun training. We took them through, even though they had it in basic training, we took them through grenades and rocket launchers and grenade launchers and pistol and rifle and all of that. One of the more amusing aspects of it, we trained with the M14 rifle. We did not get issued our M16s until after all our equipment had been packed up and shipped, and within just a week or two before we left for Vietnam, they finally had us an M16. So, and we were taken out and given a 30-round orientation firing on it. We didn't even qualify with the M16 before we went to Vietnam. Okay. But we did have to get everybody qualified with at least the M14. Mm-hmm. And we had a certain group within the battalion that were just absolutely incapable of qualifying with a rifle. They couldn't get it. But they had to be qualified in order to go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So, after Thanksgiving, after basically all of the other equipment had been packed up, the M14s were still there because we were going to take M16s. and we carried our individual weapons with us on ship.
Mm-hmm.
We had to go out and get these folks qualified. And I don't know if you're familiar with what they call the train fire firing range. It goes back to the 50s. What they found is during Korea, in the Korean War, they did a study, and they found something like 67% of the troops never fired their weapons in combat.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and the reason given was they never saw the bullseye on. Nobody had run up with a bullseye on it. So the Army changed their training during the 50s to a train fire range, and the way it worked is you actually were in a foxhole on the range,
mm-hmm.
and there were a series of berms from about 50 meters all the way down to out to 300 meters. And within your lane, targets would pop up at anywhere along that, and you had to knock the target down. And it was everything from just the head of a man at a head-size silhouette at 50 meters all the way down to a full-size silhouette maybe at 300 meters. Well, what we did to get these folks qualified is we took those of us who had shot expert, and we would put one of these individuals who couldn't shoot, and then one of us who could, and then we put two more who couldn't shoot, and then one who could, all the way down the firing range. So when the target would pop up, what I would do is I would shoot the target of the guy on the left of me, then I'd shoot the target of the guy on the right of me, and then I'd shoot my target. And that's how we qualified.
Okay.
May not have been kosher, but we got them all qualified.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose if you were in infantry, it might make more of a difference, but be that as it may, mm-hmm. it worked.
What did you think of the M16 compared to the M14?
It has its pluses and minuses. It was much easier to carry, much lighter weight. The ammunition was much lighter. You could carry more ammunition. The full automatic capability was both a blessing and a curse. If you were in a situation where you suddenly needed that kind of firepower, you couldn't beat it. But on the other hand, it wasted a tremendous amount of ammunition, and in my opinion, it caused a lot of troops to get real sloppy. They would, anytime some shooting would start, they'd immediately throw that thing on full automatic and just start spraying the tree line or spraying the woods. They never bothered to aim, and so I think it caused a real problem with accuracy in a lot of situations. The M14 was quite a bit heavier. It had much heavier round, and I think was probably better penetration capability if you had to shoot through doors or particularly if you're in a jungle situation. I think it was more probably travel through the jungle, mm-hmm. through the vegetation, better than the M16 would. I had experienced no problem with the M16 as far as malfunctions, but then again, the firefights I was in were defensive in nature. We were being usually a perimeter probe or something along that line, where we were within our fire base, or at least within the battery area. So it wasn't, we never had a situation where they tried to overrun the battery, so it was never a full-blown firefight as if the infantry were there.
Okay.
But, like I say, there were advantages and disadvantages to either one.
Okay. How much... when you got to the 9th ID at Fort Riley, how much training did you do with regard to the type of artillery fire missions you would eventually conduct in Vietnam, contrasted to the conventional style that you were taught at the basic course?
Training at Fort Riley was still conventional World War II type artillery training. We would go up on the hill, and the impact zone in almost any fort is, you go up on a hill and you have a series of bunkers you get in, which actually enough at Riley we did not. We would go up and have to establish our own position.
Mm-hmm.
But you go up on the hill and you look out over the impact area, and there would be a whole series of car bodies out there, mm-hmm. painted yellow, red, white, whatever, blue. And those would be the targets. And so the instructor or the cadre who was grading you would assign you, such and such a car body, that's your target. It's infantry in the open or it's tanks. You would describe what the target was supposed to be, but what you were shooting at was this car body.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have to determine where that car body was on your map, call the coordinates and fire mission back to the battery, and then adjust fire onto that car body. So from that standpoint, that was classic World War II type of training. We just didn't. One of the problems with doing that realistic training for Vietnam is we didn't have the facility. We didn't have, there was not the capability. Because in Vietnam, when you would call fire in, you would be calling it into your perimeter. Usually you'd call it in within 50 meters of your perimeter. The safety factor precluded engaging in the kind of training that really you dealt with in Vietnam.
Now, what about direct fire training? Did you do much of that?
We did not, to my knowledge. Now, let me correct that. At no time was I aware that we did direct fire training. There were times where but I was not with a firing battery during training at Fort Riley. I was a forward observer. I cannot categorically say that they didn't at some point take the firing battery out and give them direct fire training. I don't believe they did. But they may have. I do know, and as a result of the reunions, there were things that happened at Fort Riley that I was totally unaware of at the time. Either I was doing something else that didn't involve me, or I, whatever. But so if they did direct fire training, I am not aware of it. Now, we did do quite a bit of counter-ambush and convoy ambush training. In that, I usually commanded the aggressive forces and set up the ambushes. Because as foreign observer, I was not going to be with a battery convoy. So, but we did a substantial amount of convoy ambush training at Fort Riley.
And when you, just to keep on track with this line of thinking, when you got to Vietnam, were there ever any incidents where you actually had to use your weapons in direct fire capacity?
Yes, there were. There was one. We were not, and interestingly enough, the only weapon in the Army that has ammunition at that time for direct fire was 105 howitzer.
Which is what your unit had.
Which is what the 2nd and the 4th had.
Okay.
Towards the last 4 months of my tour was with the 78th, which was 8-inch and 175s, 8-inch calibers and 175mm guns. The only weapon I ever fired direct fire was a 175mm gun. And it was a kind of an interesting situation. We were located up in an area near Song Bay, which is up along the Cambodian border, a little town of Phuc Binh, was the village. And they had, in fact, it was the first airlift of heavy artillery in the Vietnam War. They loaded us onto C-124s, which were great, big, humongous. The ones that had the clamshell doors in the front. And flew us into an old Japanese airstrip that was long enough for those planes to land fully loaded, but they couldn't take off fully loaded. So, as far as I know, that equipment's still there rusting. And we established a fire base that had been built by the engineers. We were the first unit in there. We had four 175mm guns, and we were firing long-range artillery fire against whatever targets, core, we were essentially core artillery at the time, field force artillery, whatever targets they would give us. Off our perimeter, about 1,500 meters, was a mountain called Nui Ba Ra, which was a smaller version of the Nui Ba Dinh, I guess. And on top of that was a South Vietnamese outpost. One night we, as interesting aside, the advisor to the Vietnamese Ranger Battalion that secured that outpost happened to be a fellow I went to college with at A&M. So one night he called on the radio, and it seems that this outpost was under heavy attack by Viet Cong, North Vietnamese, somebody. And he asked if we could help. And I said, well, we've got 181mm mortar, then all we know how to fire is illumination out of it. And about that time, the battery commander came in. At this point, I was the fire direction officer of this battery. The battery commander came in, and he had been over there before with special forces. So he said to him, you know, can we fire AG, can you get train some folks fire AG out of this mortar? And he says, yeah. I said, you figure out how to do the firing data. So I'm thumbing through the book, figuring fire data for this mortar. And I said, we can, it's too close to fire the 175s unless we fire direct fire. I said, we can try firing direct fire and see what happens. And he says, at this point, anything will help. So we actually literally went out and looked through the tubes and the rounds until you got the mountain in there through the tubes of the guns, and we fired direct fire out of these 175s on the side of this mountain. At the same time, we were firing indirect fire with the 81mm mortars, and we had a couple of quad 50 machine guns on the perimeter, and eventually we began firing those indirect fire onto the side of this mountain. Well, the next morning we got up, and the Viet Cong flag is flying from this outpost, and there is a swath of bare ground, the whole length of this mountain, about three-quarters of the way up, where we had just leveled everything with these 175s. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether we accomplished anything to speak of, but that's my one experience of firing direct fire in Vietnam.
All right, so when did you actually depart for Vietnam?
Well, we actually departed Fort Riley on the 7th of January, 1967. We loaded onto a troop train, the 2nd Brigade of the 9th Division and the 2nd of the 4th Artillery. Left Fort Riley about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I remember it was a very cold, snowy day. And we started heading west on this troop train, traveled all night, and woke up, and I can actually have some pictures of this that I brought that I can show you when we pop the CD in. Woke up the next morning, and we were traveling across southern Wyoming. We had already gone to Denver and turned north from Denver, and came up the next morning traveling across southern Wyoming. It was probably a foot of snow on the ground out there, and it was obviously very cold. It's still the most desolate country I've ever seen in my life was that trip across southern Wyoming. And that took almost the entire day to make that trip across from about Laramie across the Utah border. Mm-hmm. I didn't think about much at the time, but subsequent, I have made the trip a number of times by car, and all I can say is the train must have been going very slow because it took a long time. We turned north once we got into Utah and up through Salt Lake City and then on across. By that time it was dark. We went across Utah and Nevada in the dark, and the next morning, just about dawn, we were going up the Sierra Nevadas, up through Donner Pass and Emigrant Gap, mm-hmm. and then down the western slope of the Sierras through Sacramento and on into Oakland, and they let us off at the Oakland Naval Terminal. We walked through a big warehouse-type building, and there was our troop ship, the USS General John Pope, which was an old World War II troop ship. We, in fact, I actually got a picture of it, which I found out later what it must have taken. but we loaded on that ship, and within a couple of hours had left the docks and were cruising out, you know, under the Oakland Bay Bridge and by Alcatraz and under the Golden Gate and on out into the Pacific. And it was about 18 days on the ship till we hit Okinawa. And we stopped at Okinawa. We got there about noon, and they let us off the ship for about 12 hours to run around Okinawa. Then we loaded back on the ship and took off about midnight, again, 2 o'clock in the morning. We were gone about 24 hours out in the middle of the South China Sea when about 2 o'clock in the morning, all kinds of noise is going off, klaxons and bells and things, and it appears that one of the troops had smuggled a bottle of liquor on board, had gotten drunk, and the MPs found him and arrested him and were taking him to the brig. And when they got out on deck, I guess, as I recall the story, they were going down one of the ladders, and one of the MPs went down the ladder, and then this kid went down the ladder, and then followed by the other MP. Well, When the kid got to the base of the ladder, he broke and ran and went overboard, jumped overboard in the middle of the South China Sea. So we spent 24 hours in the area looking for him, never found him. What they speculated at the time was, from the point of deck where he went over, is he probably swept into the propellers of the ship. At any rate, we spent 24 hours looking for him, so our 21-day voyage became 22. And we arrived on the coast of Vietnam on the 31st of January of 1967. Which brings up another amusing story that we still laugh at our reunions, because all of us were the sons of World War II veterans, or and had been raised on the John Wayne movies, the World War II movies. So when we get to Vung Tau Harbor, in order to get all of these troops off the ship, what do? They throw over the landing net. Mm-hmm. And here we are climbing down this landing net into a landing craft, just like Normandy. I mean, mm-hmm. We'd all seen The Longest Day, and so mm-hmm. here we are. I mean, we've got our M16s, and they issued ammunition on the ship before we got off, so we're all locked and loaded and mm-hmm. scared, and we're ready to assault the beach.
At Vung Tau.
So, and nobody bothered to tell us, you know, what we were getting into, you know. So we're all huddled together, and this ship, this landing craft, roars off across the bay, and of course you can't see anything over the sides of those things. So the first thing we see anything on the side of the landing craft is we feel it hit the beach, and they start lowering the ramp. And if we're ready to charge across and assault this beach, what do we find there but the 9th Infantry Division band playing some march music for us? Which was a bit of a letdown, to say the mm-hmm. least. Mm-hmm. So we loaded onto trucks, loaded the whole brigade on trucks, and convoyed the whole brigade then from Vung Tau to Bearcat Base Camp, mm-hmm. Which was, as I recall, a few miles east of Saigon. I could find it on a map if I had to, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Our equipment was already there. That had been shipped out by Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. and the advance party that went over had things pretty well organized, so that we moved very smoothly into place, and we were actually only in place maybe 48 hours before we went out our first field operation.
Okay. Now, you came coming into Vietnam kind of slowly on ship. When you finally did get on land beside the band playing marching music for you, what were your impressions of Vietnam as a country and the Vietnamese people as you saw them?
Well, it was different, certainly. Other than being immediately across the border into Mexico, I had never been in a foreign country before, not even Canada. In fact, my trip to Fort Benning was the first trip I'd ever had east of the Mississippi. It was the first time I realized that not everything east of Mississippi was a big parking lot and skyscrapers. And being raised in Texas, you tend to think that. So Vietnam was very strange. The trip from Vung Tau, I have very little memory of Vung Tau itself. It was, we just right off the ship on these trucks and out. I do remember the convoy riding up the road. Very narrow, two-lane road, no shoulders. And I remember going past these little regional force, popular force outposts, which were very small and looked like they were manned by maybe a squad at most of Vietnamese soldiers. And all I could think of was, you know, what a terrible place to be. It looked like they were very vulnerable to me. Perhaps they weren't. Perhaps the area was more secure than I was at that point giving it credit. But it just seemed to be that those folks were in an extremely vulnerable position, and that any time a significant force wanted to overrun one of those things, it wouldn't have been a big problem to do so. But the trip, obviously, up to Bearcat was uneventful. To the point of boring, other than the fact that we were seeing sights we'd never seen before. I've since learned that if you've seen one third world country, you to a large extent have seen them all. They all have the same or a very similar feeling to them, whether it's Asia or Africa or wherever. But at that point, again, that was the first one I'd seen. It was all very exciting in one hand and yet very boring at the other. So, but we hit Bearcat and immediately were put to work digging foxholes and trenches because standard policy over there was nobody, you didn't go to bed until you had overhead cover. So we ended up having to spend the rest of the day and much of that night making sure everybody had overhead cover, digging foxholes and trenches, and getting the just general organization, getting the guns set up and fire direction center set up. And as a forward observer, there really wasn't a lot specifically for me to do. I supervised a lot of the digging and some of that type of work, but wasn't directly involved too much in getting things set up and organized. I spent most of my time just trying to stay out of everybody's way that was working.
Okay.
One of the things particularly in an artillery unit, an artillery battery, if you're not in a combat situation, you tend to have more officers than you have use for, because your forward observers really don't have a whole lot to do within the battery area.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're almost a fifth wheel in a garrison-type situation.
Now, the convoy up to Bearcat, that didn't involve any kind of ground fire, no snipes?
Oh, no. No, it was just as secure as driving from here down to Fredericksburg.
Mm-hmm.
There were no instances at all, sniper fire, mines, or anything else.
Sure.
They had very little evidence of U.S. security. I think maybe at one or two road junctions there might have been small U.S. units, maybe a tank here or an APC there, but really no, it didn't seem to be any big attempt at providing security for the convoy. So I can only presume that road was fairly secure most of the time.
Had you received any kind of a briefing prior to departing in the convoy, and you know, what to expect, deployment in the event of fire, things like that?
Very little, I believe. I think we probably received more than I remember.
Mm-hmm.
I believe perhaps maybe the battery commander had called us together, and I do remember them making sure that the officers and NCOs were spread out amongst the trucks so that each truck had at least one officer and some NCOs with it. But I don't recall any significant briefing on what to do in event of an ambush or something along that line. Probably because the road was considered secure and the likelihood was fairly remote.
Okay. When did you first encounter Vietnamese people?
We were in Bearcat. Well, let me back up. One of the things the 9th Division had that was unique, I think, to major units in Vietnam is the 9th Division had a very strict policy against fraternization with the local population. They just absolutely did not allow it. So my contact with Vietnamese people was fairly limited, as long as I was with the 9th Division. Actually, it was pretty much limited throughout my tour over there. But my first contact, we arrived at Bearcat about 48 hours later. We deployed on our initial operation. And at that time, I was assigned as a forward observer with the 3rd Squadron, 5th Cavalry, which was the organic cavalry unit for the 9th Division. I don't remember which particular troop I was with. But they assigned me to one of the armored personnel carriers. I do remember I had the NCO was a Filipino native on that armored personnel carrier, and was a fascinating individual to talk to and talk about Philippines and how he got in the Army. I don't remember much of it. But, at any rate, we spent the next 2 weeks out in the field mostly just patrolling in an armored cavalry troop level patrols, patrolling the area out and around Bearcat. At the time I knew where I was. Now I couldn't really tell you
exactly where we went. I know we were in an area where there were rubber plantations. We were in an area where there was a lot of scrub brush. Not heavy jungle, but some areas were fairly overgrown with forest. I remember the first night. The first night we went into a perimeter defense co-located with the artillery fire base somewhere along a major highway out of Bearcat, a few miles. The second night, the second day was when we actually began active patrolling out there. The second night we went into a clearing in this brush to set up a nighttime perimeter. And the first three vehicles in the clearing were the two M60 tanks we had and the tank retriever. And the clearing was so soft that all three of those vehicles were literally buried in muck, so that this cavalry spent the rest of the night digging the three vehicles out. And I never quite figured out why the tank retriever was the third vehicle in line on the convoy, but I wasn't running the convoy. For that next 2 weeks, we spent a lot of time just, like I say, patrolling around the area. It was primarily, most of that time was during the 67 Tet ceasefire, so there was really very little activity. It was just ensuring the ceasefire stayed in place and making sure there wasn't any major Viet Cong or North Vietnamese infiltration, I think, during the Tet ceasefire. We did have a few instances where we received some sniper fire and return fire, but if we hit anybody, I'm not aware of it. I don't think anybody was. Nobody was injured, no real damage. There were a couple of times where we received sniper fire that I went ahead and called in artillery on the suspected position just because I was bored and didn't have anything better to do.
Wow.
And we figured at least maybe it'll teach them a lesson that they wouldn't do that again.
But it worked?
Well, they didn't shoot at us anymore.
Okay.
Now, what they did with the next bunch came down, I don't know, but they quit shooting at us. So, but all in all, that 2 weeks was very uneventful. Just the excitement of actually being in a combat zone and playing Army for real.
Yeah.
What
kind of rules of engagement briefing had you received when you first got to Bearcat?
Virtually none. Basically, the way artillery worked over there is the rules of engagement were really handled more at the fire direction center level. And in order to fire artillery, there were three types of clearances you had to get before you could fire artillery. You had to get U.S. ground clearance, which certified that there were no U.S. troops in the immediate area.
Mm-hmm.
You had to get Vietnamese ground clearance, which certified there were no Vietnamese troops in the immediate area.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to get U.S. air clearance, which basically gave them a chance to broadcast that artillery was being fired from a certain point along a certain direction. So, as a forward observer, I didn't really worry about rules of engagement. I would call it a fire mission, and then it was up to the fire direction center to make the determination: were they able to fire into that area, onto that target? The exception to the clearance policy was what we call a contact fire mission, when our infantry or our forward observer was actually in a firefight with the enemy. In those cases, you still had to get the clearance, but you started firing first.
Mm-hmm.
So we would fire, and as we were firing, we would notify. Mm-hmm. Instead of getting clearance, you actually notified U.S. ground clearance, Vietnamese ground clearance, and air, mm-hmm. U.S. air, that we were firing artillery on a contact fire mission.
Okay. All right, so what was it like to be a forward observer in this field artillery unit? And, excuse me, just a moment. Okay, so again, what was it like being an FO, correct?
Right.
Yeah, forward observer. And what kind of operations did you conduct?
Okay. A forward observer, of course, is an artillery officer who goes out with the infantry. There's one forward observer assigned to each infantry company. For the purpose of calling in artillery fire and adjusting artillery fire whenever the infantry may need Along with the Forward Observer himself, the Forward Observer team consists of a reconnaissance sergeant who is an E5 and a radio telephone operator who's an E4. So there's really a three-man team. From the standpoint of being a Forward Observer, the key things are you've always got to know exactly where you are. Like I said, if you don't know where you are, it's hard to call artillery fire in, and also dangerous. To a large extent, a lot of your job is, besides keeping aware of what's going on around you, is keeping track of exactly where you are, which, particularly when you're in an armored situation, you're moving fairly rapidly, and that can be almost a full-time job, just keeping track of where you are on the map, and particularly in the area we were operating in, because we weren't operating on established roads. We were working off-road and in a very brushy, scrub brush type of area, where there were no significant terrain features that you could keep track of for the most part. So that was, to a large extent, the job. It was mostly riding around on an armored personnel carrier, trying to make sure I could keep track of where I was. Once you went into a defensive position at night, your first job was to set up what they call defensive concentrations, or DEFCONs. And that would be to tour the perimeter of the infantry, or in this case the armored cavalry, had set up, decide where are the most likely avenues of attack, and make sure that you've established pre-planned artillery concentrations around the perimeter. Usually what I would do, in absence of any other better information, I would establish 4 to 6 defensive concentrations around the perimeter, and those would be numbered. Generally, I might fire in one of those before dark, and then the others would be given by coordinates. So once I knew where one was, I could be fairly safe that I had the others reasonably correct. Those would all be registered with the Battery Fire Direction Center, so that if we got attacked by night, it would be just to get artillery fire, just be a matter of calling the Fire Direction Center and requesting DEFCON 1, 2, 3, 4, or however they were numbered. And then from that point, once you got an artillery on the ground, then it was just a simple matter to adjust that fire to wherever on the perimeter it was needed. Okay. So that was the first task. Then once you got that taken care of and you made sure, I always tried to make sure that at least the platoon leaders knew where the DEFCONs in their area were located, so that if something happened to me, somebody had to still be able to call an artillery fire. Mm-hmm. And I made sure that both members of my Forward Observer team knew where they were. And so then it was a matter of really just settling in for the night. Usually we're eating sea rations, so that was a fairly quick deal. And then on the track, usually the tracks were set up wagon train fashion with the 50 caliber machine gun facing out. So we all took turns during night on night watch, man in the 50. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of how we spent the night. And the next morning we'd get up and start patrolling again. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty much of a routine. That's the one, at least the field operation that I was forward observer on, was pretty much a routine. As I said, a couple of times we did get some sniper fire in, and once or twice out of boredom more than anything else, I'd call artillery fire in on where we thought the sniper fire was coming from. And I don't know if we hit anybody or not, but it seemed to stop the sniper fire, so that accomplished my objective.
Mm-hmm. How many men would be on one of these patrols? And how many tracks?
It's hard to remember now. It was actually a troop, which would be roughly equivalent to an infantry company. Mm-hmm. Infantry company is about 185 men, if you have the whole company out there. So let's see, and we had some tanks. So I would venture to say we probably had 15 to 18 track vehicles with us on this, counting the tanks and the tank retriever and the armored personnel carriers. So okay. I would expect it. I think it's probably 15 to 18 vehicles on this particular patrol.
The tracks you're talking about are M113.
Yes, APCs were M113s, and then we had M60 tanks. There was one. I think they had one of the, whatever the number was, the command tracks, the big high ones. And since we had tanks, we had the big tank retriever as opposed to the smaller track vehicle retriever, and I've forgotten all the numbers of those.
Okay.
But the primary vehicle was the M113 armored personnel carrier.
Okay. And the artillery that you have was all towed artillery, is that
correct? Yes. It was the old M101A1, 105 howitzer, weighed about 5,000 pounds. It was the same 105 howitzer that was used in World War II. In fact, most of ours were veterans of World War II and the Korean War. They went.
This is CD number 2, the interview with Tom Striegler. I was going to spit it out.
I quickly forget.
No, I was going to say Striegler.
No, German pronunciation.
I know, because the I is before the E, it's a hard E. Okay. Okay, so when you would go out on these patrols, you take occasional sniper fire. What about heavier unit contact?
Well, this was during the 67 Tet ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, the ceasefire was observed by both sides. We did not have, during those 2 weeks that I was out in the field, any heavy unit contract. We had nothing other than sniper fire. And then at the end of about 2 weeks, in fact, I think it was six, you know, I made some notes here on dates. It was the 16th of February, so it was right at 2 weeks. I estimated that we started that operation on February 2nd. And on February 16th, I was pulled out of the field as forward observer and reassigned as executive officer of B Battery because the current executive officer, Fred Chesbrough, had been relieved as executive officer by the division artillery commander for reasons which really didn't make a whole lot of sense to anybody, but that's command prerogative. So I was assigned as executive officer and Ches replaced me as forward observer with A Battery. At that point, we were still on that operation. So I went from being out with the combat units, ready to call in or calling in artillery fire, to being in command of the firing battery delivering the artillery fire. And we spent about 2 more days on that operation, and then returned to Bearcat. And during that time, there were no significant enemy contacts. We came back into Bearcat just at the end of the Tet ceasefire, so there was really no significant enemy action during that period. We returned to Bearcat and were there only about 48 hours, just long enough to clean up equipment and replenish our ammunition supplies and so forth. And then we were sent on our first air mobile operation, which was quite a fiasco. We had not had any air mobile training at Fort Bragg. So about 9 o'clock that night, somebody brought us a manual on how to rig all the stuff for air mobile and told us we had to have it ready by daylight the next morning, which we were singularly unsuccessful at. So when the helicopter showed up on the landing field, we were not at all ready, which made for some very irate helicopter pilots who had to get out of their helicopters and come back and show us how to give us a quick course in how to rig artillery for air mobile. But we got it done, and they hauled us down into an island on the in the Rungsat Special Zone south of Saigon. Mm-hmm. And initially we were in, all I can best describe it as, was just almost a dry mud flat down there. Set up the artillery, set up the battery, got settled in, and we only spent about 2 days in that position. And again, no significant activity happened. Then they relocated us, again, by air mobile. The only way to get in or out was air mobile. Mm-hmm. By this time, we figured out how to rig everything, so we knew what we were doing. And moved us over to another island adjacent to a small Vietnamese fishing village. And I've got some pictures of that, by the way. And we sat on that island for about a month. And most of that time we ate sea rations. There was no fresh food brought in. The only thing we would bring in would be additional ammunition. had, at that point, honestly had no idea why we were there. I read later in some history books that what we were doing was training the Mobile Riverine Force, that in fact we were the chosen artillery battalion for the Mobile Riverine Force.
Hmm.
But we never were really a part of Mobile Riverine Force. So I understand, found out this last reunion, that apparently the brigade commander for the Mobile Riverine Force and our battalion commander did not get along well, so the division made an adjustment and sent us elsewhere and put another battalion with the Mobile Riverine Force. At any rate, we spent a month on the in the Rumsat on this island. There was really no way to dig in. Fortunately, we never encountered enemy activity ourselves. There was no way to dig in, because if we did, we would dug ourselves out of house and home. So it was just a matter of, everybody had cots set up, we had a few tents set up, and after about a week, I was laying there asleep one night in my cot, and I kind of dropped my hand off and felt water. And I realized that the water was almost up to the level of my cot. What they forgot to tell us was that we were about 12 feet above high tide, and high tide was about 14 feet in this area, so we spent several nights there getting flooded out twice a day every time a high tide showed up. First time we lost, most of our ammunition got wet because we weren't expecting it. So we had to be completely resupplied with ammunition. After that, we figured it out and got our ammunition up off the ground.
Wow.
But we did spend, it was a kind of a harrowing. Some of the guys were sleeping on the ground with air mattresses and they woke up floating. The other interesting thing about that was that all the creepy crawlies were looking for high ground.
Yes.
And I guess it was the second night of that we knew the floods were coming then. The second night I was asleep in my cot, which I did find would stay just above the water level when high tide came in. But I woke up in the middle of the night with a feeling of pressure on my chest. And I kind of looked down and I was staring eyeball to eyeball with the biggest rat I have ever seen in my life, that had obviously swum over and found this nice warm bed. I did not have a calm reaction to that. I screamed and leapt up, and I've always said it was fortunate I couldn't find my .45, because I probably would have killed half the battery going after the rat. But once the tide, monthly high tide, went back down, things were back to normal again. I did find, at one point, I lifted up my air mattress off my cot, and I found two nests of ants and a couple of lizards and a few centipedes had taken up a residence under my air mattress during the flood. So I had to get rid of all those. But all in all, other than the fact that we spent 30 days eating nothing but sea rations, there one morning, for whatever reason, they flew in a bunch of fresh eggs. And so the cook gave us all fresh eggs for breakfast, and that was probably the best meal I've ever eaten in my life. And we ate sea rations for 30 days straight, to the point that, I don't know how anybody else was, but I was so sick of it that from then on, if it came down to eating sea rations, I generally skipped the meal. It was just, they were good rations, they were very nourishing, but after a while they got real old.
Yep.
The couple of other instances on that, at that point, at one point the Vietnamese brought a child to us whose leg had been cut, I think it was with like a caning knife, from pretty much from knee to ankle, laid open the bone. And so we called back the battalion and got the battalion surgeon flown in to sew that up and take care of that. They also, on the one end of the island, just outside the village, was a little boat repair operation, which was fascinating to watch these boats, which were just completely rotted out from the hull, and they would do all kinds of measuring, and then they'd stake a few stakes from the ground and bend the board to the right curve. Then they'd build a fire up against that board to set that bend in it, and then when they picked that board up, it would just fit perfectly right onto the bow of that boat. Just amazing craftsmanship. After a month there, there was some minor enemy contact with the infantry out there, and we did fire some contact fire missions. during that period, but not anything that I would call significant. There were more ambush patrols and that sort of thing. The only other significant incident during that period is about mid-morning one morning, just felt like the world was blowing up right off our perimeter, and it was just this huge series of explosions with geysers of water and mud obviously going up what appeared to be hundreds of feet in the air, and our ground would actually tremble. So I got on the radio and called battalion and asked them if they knew of anything going on, and they said, oh yeah, we were supposed to have mentioned it to you, but there was a three-plane B-52 strike about 4,000 meters off your perimeter, which was probably the most impressive thing I saw in Vietnam, was this B-52 strike. It was even more impressive, the fact we didn't know it was coming. But after a month in the Rumsat, we were air mobile back to the Bearcat, and that would have been, by my guess, around the 13th or 14th of March of 1967. Okay. We spent a couple of days in Bearcat, a day or two in Bearcat to clean up and get everybody dried out. And then on the 16th of March, we moved down into Long An Province, becoming the... to support the 3rd Brigade of the 9th Division, becoming the first U.S. combat troops into the Mekong Delta. We set up in a dry rice paddy just outside, off the edge of the village of Binh Phuc, about 7 or 8 miles south of Tan An, which was the provincial capital and battalion headquarters. At that point, we were in direct support of the 5th Battalion, 60th Infantry, which was a mechanized infantry battalion. And we remained in support of them until I left the 9th Division in August, and actually, I think, the B Battery, the 2nd and 4th, remained in support of the 5th and 60th, so sometime after the Tet Offensive of 68. As I say, when we first moved in there, the fire base had not yet been constructed. In fact, the engineers were just starting to build it after we got there and secured the area. So we were in a dry rice paddy, set up in a dry rice paddy with infantry providing security for the fire base that we had. And things got hot very rapidly there. We took occasional sniper fire into the firebase area, but fortunately, we were a little careful about doing too much about that, because a sniper or snipers that were assigned to us were not particularly good shots, and we kind of developed the philosophy that if we happened to do anything to them, they might bring somebody in who was a good shot, so it was easier just to put up with them as a nuisance as opposed to do anything about it. It's kind of the devil you know type of approach. The 5th and the 60th was very leery of artillery when we first became associated with them. They had had some unfortunate incidences. I don't know the details of those, but they really didn't want to use artillery when we first got down to Binh Phuc. That lasted for a few days. Our four reserves would go out, they would get into a firefight, and the company commander would tell them, don't call for artillery. It was very frustrating for everybody. Within a week, however, one of the companies, or either company or platoon, I don't recall which, was out one evening, and it must have been a platoon, got hit very hard. Were in danger of being overrun. They had no choice but to call for artillery. We fired support and broke the attack. And from then on, we were their artillery. The battalion commander would not move without us, his battery. There were incidents, which we'll get into later, where he was told to go on an operation in another part of the area, and artillery would be provided, and he would just have to refuse to move without his artillery battery with him. So the next few months, throughout the rest of the time I was there, that area and that entire area that the 3rd Brigade was in Long An Province was extremely hot. We lost a number of casualties in the battalion. B Battery did not lose any, had none killed, although I think as a battery, we had the highest casualty rate of any battery in the battalion. We had more wounded. The infantry would go out on patrols throughout around the area. Invariably, they would get into enemy contact almost every time they went out. We were firing contact missions often several times a day. Many times, they would send a company to one area or another outside of our area, outside of the range of our sort of fire base. If it was an entire battalion going out, we would take the entire battery out. One time, we were traveling south and east of Ben Phu, which was one of the major areas of operation, out all the, over towards areas of Rock Hien and Tan Tru. And we were in convoy with the infantry going out to set up a fire base out there so we could keep them within range. And the head of our convoy was actually ambushed by Viet Cong. So we had to pull off the road and lay our guns and fire artillery support in support of the head of our own convoy, which one of the things we were trained to do. It's called a hip shoot. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the training things that you practice and practice and practice in artillery is to, if you're in convoy, to take a fire mission on the run, pull off, find a location, pull off, and lay your guns and fire. And you're actually tested and timed on that in any kind of combat readiness test on how fast you can get the first round out on a hip shoot.
Now, how far up was the head of the column?
About 1,500 meters.
1,500 meters.
About a little, about a mile. I mean, you're talking a battalion of mechanized infantry plus a battery of artillery. That's a lot of vehicles stretched out. And we were kind of towards the rear of the convoy.
So that you could provide that support in the event that it was needed.
Yes. And
now, what was the minimum distance you had to be away from the head of the column or the from the attack in order to provide indirect support?
Well, we could provide it fairly effectively at about 1,500 meters or maybe even a little less. Mm-hmm. You get much less than that, you're almost talking direct fire.
Yeah.
But on more than one occasion, we would fire at 1,600 meters. In one situation, one of the early operations, in fact, the first operation where the battery actually came under fire, we were down southwest of Ben Phu, out in the rice paddy, and it was several days of operation. We were just in a dry rice paddy, secured by infantry, and about the second night there, we came under mortar attack in the battery area. Did not have any casualties, but mortar and actually there were small arm fire coming in off the perimeter too. But in that particular operation on the last day, we were actually firing with less than 1,500 meters to the point that we could actually see our own maneuver elements and see the Viet Cong we were firing on and in the tree line just across the highway. So, I mean, it was that close that we could actually watch the firefight and watch our own rounds hit.
Do your own adjustments.
Well, you could, yes, we could have, except that not being on the ground,
right.
We didn't know where all the forces were,
yes.
So you would never do that unless you were in adjusting for your own defense.
Yes. Now, and you mentioned that you were actually timed on that hip shoot.
Yes.
What was the standard time that you had to at least fall under?
I want to say that from the time you got the initial fire mission call, you had to have around the air in 5 minutes. I believe that was... Probably.
And your guys usually could do it?
Oh, yes. Well, if you didn't do it, you weren't combat ready.
Okay. So it's a combat readiness test.
It's a combat readiness test that you would have to have around. And I believe it was 5 minutes, either 5 or 7 minutes.
Wow.
So, and we were fortunate on this one. Actually, we beat the time, I'm sure, because we were fortunate in the fact that we didn't have to locate a position. You know, we had dry rice paddies on both sides of us, so we were able to just pull off. And in fact, as I recall, what we did just to make sure, because we weren't sure how dry the rice paddies were, we basically unhooked the howitzer from the truck, left the howitzers on the road, and pulled the trucks off the rice paddies. So it was just a matter of stopping the trucks, unhooking the howitzers, and moving the prime movers out of the way. And then, of course, you had to lay the battery. And by laying the battery means getting all six guns pointed exactly the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that with, or at least in those days, you did it with the means of what's called an aiming circle, which was a combination compass and telescopic sight set up in mills.
Mm-hmm.
In artillery, we always thought worked in mills instead of degrees. There are 6,400 mills in a circle. Mm-hmm. So the first thing you have to do is, and that was the job of the executive officer, is to, first thing you have to do is lay the battery so that by giving a reading to each gun, the sight on each gun, they give a reading back until those two readings match. Then you knew that gun was pointed the direction you wanted it pointed, and you'd have to get all six guns pointed in exactly the same direction. Mm-hmm. And then from there, while I would be out laying the battery, the fire direction officer and the fire direction center would be calculating the firing data. Mm-hmm. And so
it's a lot of work in 5 minutes.
It's a lot of work, but like I said, we had lots of practice at it. Mm-hmm. And anytime, what we did is anytime we pulled into a new position, we treated it as a hit shoot. So that anytime we pulled into a new position, our policy was we were to be ready, at least be ready to put the first round out in 5 minutes. So that was just kind of the way we kept in training.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Real quick question going back to your time on the island.
Mm-hmm.
What size was that island and how many Vietnamese were on it?
I honestly don't know how many Vietnamese were on it. The village was off our perimeter. It looked like it wasn't a large village, but it wasn't just a tiny village either, and I'm just not sure how many Vietnamese. The island itself, at least the area we occupied, was probably 100 meters long by maybe 30 meters, 40 meters wide. Not quite as big as a football field, probably.
Pretty small island.
Pretty small. Now, the island was much bigger than that, but that was the area we occupied on it. Mm-hmm. We had a river running on one side of the east side of the area, mm-hmm. and there was a canal or a drainage ditch and a berm mm-hmm. that probably was part defensive and part flood control for the village mm-hmm. on the other side. And to the north of us was just mangrove swamp, and to the south of us was actually the island formed a junction. Two rivers, two canals, two whatever these were. Mm-hmm. This was really in the, I think, pretty much the delta of the Saigon River area. So two of these channels kind of came together at a point at the south side of the line.
Gotcha. Okay. And just out of curiosity, you mentioned some of your interaction with animals there. Were there any other incidents that you recall, especially with poisonous snakes, spiders, other animals?
Well, the only other significant incident was, again, well, and a matter of fact, it was on the same operation where we did the hip shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Once we got that situation under control, we went on down the road and established a fire base, again, out in a dry rice paddy. And one of our policies was that, and it was standard policy, I think, with everybody over there, is that you had to have at least foxholes. You wanted overhead cover, but sometimes in the Delta that wasn't possible. So everybody had to have a foxhole available before you went to bed at night. Well, I'm digging my foxhole, and as I get down into it, I found a whole bunch of, ran into a nest actually of small snakes, little black and white snakes, about 6-8 inches long. They were obviously had not been hatched out too much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And being a wildlife management major and kind of having a live and let live policy generally, I just kind of tossed them all off into the berm around my foxhole. And we kind of got along just fine there for, I don't know, a week or whatever we were out there. I had no idea what they were at the time. Later, I did a little checking on them. Turned out they were rice cobras. But they didn't bother me, and I didn't bother them, so we were happy. But that was the only other significant incident with wildlife over there that I had.
Okay. No tigers, no monkeys?
No, not down in the Delta. The tigers were up.
Yeah.
You know, they would have been found up in the jungle.
Yeah.
Monkeys, again, were up in the jungle. I was never in an area. While I did get up into the Central Highlands, on the edge of the Central Highlands, a couple times, never in an area where there were monkeys or other significant wildlife.
Okay. And you mentioned when you moved to Long An that there was some hesitancy on the part of the unit you were supporting to call in artillery fire.
That's correct.
I would imagine you alluded to there must have been some friendly fire incident that was involved with their...
I'm presuming there probably was, yes.
While you were in Vietnam as a field artillery officer, were there any friendly fire incidents that you were directly aware of? Or?
Yes. There were a couple with our A battery. One was questionable whether it was our artillery or whether it was the infantry mortar fire, but we got the blame for it. A battery got the blame for it. There was another one, I don't know the details of it, with A battery again, where they fired across some no fire line or something, and again, I don't know the details of that. There was an incident. We had, in addition to our battery located at Ben Thuc, there were a couple of South Vietnamese artillery guns, two howitzers there, 105s. They fired into a village between us and Tan An one night and killed a couple of people. And in all honesty, I don't think there's an artillery battery that served in Vietnam that didn't fire a mistake at some point. Most of us were lucky and didn't hit anybody. At least didn't hit any rifles. But so the friendly fire was more a matter of luck than anything else. It's hard for me to blame anybody on a friendly fire situation, because you're looking at situations where, particularly if you're in heavy combat, you guys on guns have been up maybe 40 hours straight with virtually no sleep. People in the fire direction center have, human error happens. I also was aware of several instances of friendly fire involving our own infantry getting into firefights with each other because they didn't recognize each other. We had one where they called in, and a platoon leader called in and said, "We're receiving fire from across the river. We need to know if that's friendly or enemy." And the response was, "Well, it's friendly, but don't worry, they're shooting at the enemy." The most significant one that I recall was one of our forward observers who was out and his infantry company, and they came under heavy fire from a South Vietnamese infantry company. And so he called back to me, and since I had a direct line to our artillery liaison officer located with the South Vietnamese commander, I asked if I'd call over and tell him to stop shooting, which I did, and the liaison officer can relay that. But dealing with South Vietnamese sometimes is very frustrating. I don't know if it was just they were stubborn and they weren't going to do what the Americans told them, if they just didn't understand, or what was going on. Anyway, the fire continued. So we tried again. I called again and said, "You're firing at U.S. troops, knock it off." Mm-hmm. And the fire continued. So I called the forward observer back and I said, "Give me some coordinates." And he said, so he did. So we ran the firing data through. One of the things the 9th Division did in artillery that nobody else did, and we were criticized for it, but I think it saved a lot of lives. First round out was always a white phosphorus round at 200 meters in the air. And what that meant was if you had a mistake, you recognized it without hurting anybody. Mm-hmm. So what we did, we figured up the firing data, and I put out a white phosphorus right over their heads. And I called the liaison officer. I said, "I've already got white phosphorus on top of them." I said, "Next one's going to be a battery 6. And I had the battery loaded when they stopped firing. So that was the main incident. Fortunately, there were no casualties, but that was the main incident, friendly fire that I recall.
That was an Arvin battery.
It was an Arvin infantry company firing on a U.S. infantry.
What were they firing? Small arms?
Small arms, rifle grenades. I don't know if there are any mortars involved or not. Okay. Small arms firing.
Were there ever any incidents where you actually had to fire on an Arvin unit that had...
No.
Okay.
No. There were instances where I actually fired on top of our own troops, but that was intentional. As one platoon leader put it when he called in for the fire, I went back, he called for fire, and I went back and I said, "That's right on top of your own position," and his response was, "Well, that's where Charlie is." And so we did. In fact, more than once we fired on top of our own position because that's where they needed the artillery fire. And there were friendly casualties from our own artillery fire, but it was not an accident.
Right.
We would have to fire so close to our own infantry that we took some casualties from our own artillery. But that's true of any combat situation.
They wouldn't call those in as danger close missions, or?
Well, it doesn't matter. Yes, it was danger close.
Right, but I mean, so that you would already know that they recognized that this was either...
They were well aware.
Right.
I mean, everybody was aware of what we were doing.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't... Yes, it was danger close. All danger close means is we're going to be very careful about how we put the data on the gun, but we're
right.
still going to go
right.
where we fire.
Right.
And but we would be firing, in some cases, we would be firing, if not on top of our own positions, within 10 or 15 meters of our own position.
Goodness.
You know, it's just the situation would be that desperate.
How often did that happen?
I can remember at least a half dozen times where I would have to fire either on top of our own position or so close that I expected to incur friendly casualties.
Did you have to provide, or did you ever provide fire support for Arvin units in the field?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we did in any number of situations. We would provide support for Arvin units. It was almost routine.
Okay.
The most significant one was an operation called Concordia 2, which occurred down at a place called Kai Lei, which is down further down in the Delta. We had been there. We went on a couple of operations down there. Both times were turned into major battles. On this occasion, we hit, set up our fire base and started firing, and over a period of 48 hours, we fired over 4,000 rounds, continuous fire. In fact, it was so chaotic that the infantry battalion commander was in my fire direction center because we were the only ones that had radio contact with everybody and knew where everybody was. And on that particular situation, well, that was, again, one of the times we fired right on top of our own troops. The last morning, the infantry reconnaissance platoon woke up, or when daylight appeared, I should say they woke up, when daylight appeared, they found themselves surrounded by an overwhelming force that attacked. And so they just buttoned up the tracks, and we put airburst right on top of them for about a half hour and broke the attack. And then immediately after that, a company of Vietnamese Marines, South Vietnamese Marines, got into real trouble, and we ended up firing in support of them for a couple of hours to bail them out. But during this whole thing, at some point, I don't remember exactly when, a South Vietnamese battalion got into significant trouble, and we had to bail them out with artillery fire. And just before we were leaving, as we were packing up, the battalion commander of that infantry, South Vietnamese battalion, showed up and presented, since at that time I was a senior officer in the battery, presented me with a Viet Cong flag that is an appreciation for the support we had provided them. And a long story, which largely I've forgotten, about how they had captured the flag. My personal opinion was they probably had a bunch of women sewing them in the village to hand out to the Americans. But at any rate, that flag, 2 years ago, I presented to the 2nd Battalion, 4th Artillery at Fort Sill, and I've got some pictures here for the display that they've got it displayed in their battalion museum now.
Oh, excellent.
So, but yes, it was not uncommon to fire in support of Vietnamese units. One time, one incident, later on in my tour, when I was with 7th and 8th, this friend of mine from college was the advisor to the Vietnamese Ranger Battalion up out of Song Bay. And he called in one night. They were being hit with recoilless rifle fire, RPG, rocket-propelled grenade fire, and wanted to know if I could do anything for him. And we had 175mm guns, which are not the most accurate artillery weapon in the world. But I said, sure, we'll take a shot at it. And so I said, give me some coordinates. Well, this was after dark, so he was guessing at the coordinates of where this thing was, just by the muzzle flash. So he gave me the coordinates, and I said, okay, we're going to put one round out, and then you adjust from there. Well, we put the round out, and there was dead silence on the radio. Absolute dead silence. I called, got no response. So I'm figuring I've wiped out a Vietnamese outpost. That lasted for about a half hour, and then this guy calls back, and he said, "Sorry about the silence." He said, "I wanted to send a patrol out." He said, "They stopped shooting. I want to send a patrol out before I call you back. Thanks." Well, the patrol got out there. Turned out we had made a direct hit with our first round on this recoilless rifle. So every once in a while, things happen.
Talk about lucky.
It was pure dumb luck, absolute dumb luck. But and the 175, for all its reputation for inaccuracy, there were times that it could prove extremely accurate. We had a situation back down in the Delta when I was back with the heavy artillery, but back down to the 49th Division. In fact, one of my Forward Observer friends was calling the fire in. They had gotten outside of their own artillery support, and we were the only guns that could support them. They were under heavy attack. We were the only guns that could support them, and it was max range, 20 miles. We were notoriously inaccurate at 20 miles. And he called, wanted to know if we could provide support. Well, you just didn't provide direct support with a 175. I mean, the accuracy's not there. You're talking a 150-pound projectile, bursting radius or kill radius of 90 meters. So it just wasn't something you did. So I kind of tried to talk him out of it, and his response was, "Well, it couldn't be much worse off than we are right now." So I said, "Okay." And the real unfortunate part is they were on the gun target line, which means it's your arrow right and left is not too bad, but you could have a 200-meter arrow just from one round to the next in range arrow. So we ended up firing direct support at max range with 175, and that lasted for about a half hour. Yeah. Fortunately, as far as I know, there were no friendly casualties from the artillery on that. So we did a lot of things with artillery in Vietnam that were virtually unheard of prior to that point.
Now, in an hour of firing, how many rounds did you generally put out?
On a 175, you were limited, or 8-inch howitzers, you were limited. Your max rate of fire was about 2 rounds every 3 minutes. A 105, you could go a lot faster. In fact, a 105, you could put out on a barrage, what we call a barrage, where you just put everything out for about 2 minutes. We could put about 180 rounds out of a 6-gun battery in 2 minutes out of a 175 battery. But if you exceeded max rate of fire for any length of time with an 8-inch or 175, you're going to overheat the tubes, and then you could have some real problems. The round could cook off inside the tube, and that make everybody's day unpleasant.
Did that ever happen?
It has happened. It didn't happen to me, but I've known it to happen. So you had to be careful when you were firing for long periods of time. You had to be careful not to exceed your max rate of fire.
Okay.
And what we were trying to do that is often we would alternate guns, so that we would try and keep one or two guns firing at the same time. But we didn't, so in a half hour, you know, you can kind of compute the math, but you aren't going to get that many rounds out. But when you're talking 150 or 200 pound projectile, can make a difference. Just a few of them.
Okay. Now let me ask you one of the bigger questions. As a field artillery officer, what did you understand to be the purpose for the American force presence in Vietnam when you arrived and while you were there?
Well, when I went over and while I was there, my understanding was that we were going over there to help the South Vietnamese defend themselves from communist aggression. And the entire time I was over there, that's what I believed we were doing, and I still believe we were doing that. A lot of folks have either, you know, want to revise history and say, well, it was a civil war. To some extent, there may have been, since you had both the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, but there was also a treaty line that both sides had signed. The 17th parallel, and the North Vietnamese were coming up across the 17th parallel and around it, and the Viet Cong were under the direct control of the North Vietnamese. They were not the as far as I know, an independent rebellious force. They were under direct control of the North Vietnamese at all times. So I still believe that we were over there defending South Vietnam from communist aggression. Whether we should have been doing that or not is a different issue, but I think if you take it in the time, place, and context, it was probably at that time the only thing we could have done. You know, today, given the world situation, it's a lot easier to look back and say, well, it didn't make a difference. I'm not convinced that, in fact, we took a stand over there, even though we didn't, weren't successful. I'm not convinced that it didn't make a difference.
What did you think of the strategy that was being employed by the Army when you were in Vietnam?
Well,
not retrospectively, but you remember what you thought on the ground?
At the time, I had no idea what strategy was being involved. I barely knew what tactics we were doing, to be honest. Strategy is something that's done at high level, knowing a lot more than I even know today about the Vietnam War, much less what I knew as a second or first lieutenant in an artillery battery sitting over there. So we didn't even, as far as I know, I never gave strategy a moment's thought when I was over there. My main concerns were keeping my men alive and putting fire on the target and keeping as many as possible of the infantry from getting killed. And killing as many of the enemy as I possibly could. Beyond that, I really didn't worry about, or never gave any thought about the bigger picture, as it were, or the strategies involved, or any of that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, what did you think about the American leadership that was in charge of American forces in Vietnam?
Well,
both your immediate leaders and then also above them.
It's hard to make a judgment above roughly the battalion level because I didn't have any contact above that. And I say that with some exceptions. The division artillery commander that we had when we went over there, a full colonel, I was not impressed with at all. I had very little contact with the man, but he did not impress me, even as a second lieutenant and being a full colonel. I was singularly unimpressed with the man. Our battalion commander that we went over with, I was not too impressed with at the time, and neither, even at talking in reunions, people who knew him better than I did, none of them were particularly impressed with him. Although I actually ended up next to him on an airplane from San Francisco to Kansas City on the way home. And we had a long talk, and I became more impressed with him after talking to him on a very one-on-one personal type of situation than I was. Because, and part of that was, everything I heard from him was filtered down through my immediate superiors. And the other thing is that talking to him directly, I began to realize how much of what I considered stupid things we did were at the direction of this division artillery commander. So I think I bear him much less ill will than I did, than maybe many of the folks who didn't have that opportunity. That division artillery commander was replaced with another colonel who was, in my opinion, an outstanding officer.
Before you talk about him, what kinds of stupid things or mundane things would the other commander have you do that were so troublesome or bothersome?
Well, it's...
Do you recall specifics?
It's really hard to recall the specifics now because I really haven't thought that much about them since then, but it just, the term Mickey Mouse was always, you know, just the Mickey Mouse kinds of things that it was almost as if you could understand doing some of that stuff in a garrison situation at Fort Riley, but then once you got into combat, it was time, okay, let's get rid of the Mickey Mouse, we've got a job to do over here. And some of the folks just didn't seem to be willing to get rid of that. Mm-hmm. Another officer was a battalion executive officer, which, again, was very poorly thought of, even worse than the battalion commander. This was a major. Mm-hmm. And I can give you a specific example with him of the kind of thing we had to put up with. We came under fire, the battery area came under fire one night. It was a combination of rifle grenades and small arms fire. And the next morning, the battalion or the battalion executive officer comes in. He grabs me and wants to tour the battery area, you know, see what happened. Well, there's not much to show him, you know. But he said, "Well," he said, "did you do crater?" He said, "Did you do crater analysis?" And I said, "Well, no." I said, "You, it's kind of hard. There weren't really any craters." And he said, "Well, show me where they hit." And I said, "Well, sir, these were rifle grenades. They weren't mortar rounds. They weren't artillery rounds. They were rifle grenades." He said, "Well, show me where." Well, I found a couple of little pock marks in the what was essentially dry mud. It was almost like concrete. And I showed it to him, whether they were in fact the result of these rifle grenades coming in or not, I don't know. But it made him happy.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, "Well, is that all?" And I said, "Well, sir, there was small arms fire coming in also." And he said, "How do you know it was incoming small arms fire?" And at that point, I was never really tactful. At that point, I just looked at him and I said, "Sir, have you ever been shot at?" And he says, "No." And I said, "Well, let me tell you, when you are, you'll know whether it's incoming or not." But it was that kind of mentality that we had to deal with when we first got over there. Now, the as a result of the second friendly fire incident with A Battery, the battalion commander, the battalion exec, the battery, I don't know if the battery commander was relieved, but they did relieve a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a new battalion commander in who came down shortly after he arrived. This would have been late April of 67. And put the battery in formation. And by that time, everybody was getting a little skittish on this friendly fire issue. Although we had not been affected ourselves, we were still pretty nervous about it. And he got the battery in formation, and he stood up there and he said, "Okay," he said, I want y'all to understand just one thing." He said, "We're artillery." And he said, "When we shoot artillery, we hurt people." He said, "Our job is to make sure we hurt more of them than we do of us." And that attitude kind of relieved a lot of the tension that was going on. You're still worried about every round that went out.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't quite so fearful as it was under the previous regime, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So with the new battalion commander, and we got a new battery exec, our battalion exec officer in, and a new division artillery commander, then things kind of straightened out. These folks all seemed to understand that, yeah, we were over there to fight a war. At the lower local level, at the battery level, the battery commander that Fort Riley, for A Battery, that was my battery commander, was probably the finest officer I have ever served with in the Army. Probably the finest supervisor I ever had. When I left A Battery and went to B Battery, the battery commander was adequate but strange. He would come in the middle of the night, make me put the entire battery on full alert because he had a dream, and in the dream his father had told him we were going to get hit that night. So we were dealing with a guy that may not have been playing the full deck. When he left, they brought in a lieutenant, first lieutenant for battery commander, who was a fine officer, although he apparently had been in more trouble than not during his military career. I think he just couldn't deal with the authority and tend to rebel against it. But as far as being a battery commander, he was a fine battery commander, best I've ever had. And what was happening is they were trying to get everybody their command timing. So every 2 months they'd send me a new battery commander. So it was kind of like I was exec officer of this battery for 6 months of my tour, and yet I went through three or four battery commanders during this period. So we were just rotating battery commanders through to get their command time on paper. The guy after the next one was again a very poor officer. Besides not being particularly competent, he was a coward, which didn't endear him to me particularly or anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he was still the battery commander when I left and went on to the 7th, the 8th, the heavier artillery unit. And over there, basically all the battery commanders I had were very good. the difference, though, which was interesting, and we were talking about this at the reunion, the real difference that struck me between those two battalions was not in the officers, but the NCOs. I think the 2nd or the 4th had probably the finest group of NCOs that I ever knew in the Army. Just absolutely outstanding NCOs. And 7th and 8th were, at best, mediocre. So it was, that is where I noticed the real difference. And that, I think, is, I think the NCOs make more of a difference, by far, than the officers were, ever will. But I just found that the NCOs in the 2nd and 4th were just absolutely outstanding.
Why can you account for the difference? Why?
I think just luck of the draw. Just absolute luck of who got sent where, when. I don't think there was any tangible thing you could put your finger on. It's just, I just found the 2nd and 4th NCOs just to be top caliber. And I think that was proven out because several of them retired as command sergeant majors, or first sergeants. I mean, they retired very high NCO ranks. What happened to those in the 78th, I don't know, but I do know the 2nd and 4th NCOs, a large percentage of them retired at very high level.
How do you think the high rotation rate for the battery commanders affected unit morale?
Interestingly enough, I don't think it had a lot of effect on morale because in an artillery battery, the executive officer commands a firing battery, and that's roughly three-quarters of the battery. So the battery commander, really, while he is an overall commander of the battery and makes those kinds of those full unit decisions, the fact that I was there for 6 months added the stability for the firing battery. So what the only things that weren't directly under me were the maintenance section, the mess hall, and the battery headquarters. Everything else was either a gun section or a fire direction center or the ammunition section. So I think the fact that I was there for so long tended to offset it. And not only me, but the rest of the officers and the NCOs were by and large there for most of that time. So I think that tended to offset the fact they were just rotating battery commanders through on a regular basis.
So, but how do you think that high rotation affected the overall capabilities and effectiveness of the artillery units?
Probably not. And you know, one of the things, going back into history a little bit, one of the things I read either during the Vietnam War or shortly after was a critique that the fact that we were only over there a year and then came home affected the combat effectiveness of the U.S. Army, because just about the time you learned your job, you would go, you'd be out of there and they'd bring somebody new in. And yet, if you really think about it, U.S. troops landed in Normandy in June of 1944. Less than a year later, the war was over with. So we actually had more time in combat than a GI that went ashore at Normandy. And the fact is, if you read about casualty rates in the European theater, people didn't last that long. I mean, a platoon leader might be there, if he's lucky, he might make 30 days, and then they have another one in. So in combat, you're going to have high turnover. You are going to have a high turnover rate. And I don't think that the turnover rate of battery commanders was particularly that significant. I think what they tended to do was leave people like fire direction officers and maybe exec officers in place longer, because I think they had more effect on the actual performance of the unit, because they were the ones that got the rounds out and got the rounds on target. So I just don't really believe that turnover made a whole lot of difference.
Okay. And did you have a lot of turnover in terms of your NCOs and enlisted men, or?
We had some early turnover in NCOs. Two or three of them were moved out, but for the most part, the enlisted men, and we had turnover in enlisted men, because we went in as a unit, they had what they call an infusion program, where we would send people out, and they'd bring people in. So we did have some constant turnover. But there were some NCOs and officers that stayed, if not the entire tour, certainly the majority of it. And I think that tended to help maintain some continuity there. Kind of getting back to, you know, a little bit more of the history of some of this. We've kind of got ahead of things. A couple of things. One of the things when we got down in the Mekong Delta there, we got down there on March 15th, I believe.
And March, Kai Lai?
No, or? March 15th, we got into to Binfook. Okay. That's when we actually got into the Delta, okay. Binfook. Mm-hmm. On March 16th, we lost our first casualties. Both Mike King and Fred Chesbrough, who were forward observers of the A battery, were killed in action on the same day. And both of those I had replaced. I mean, they were, Mike and I had, battery commander had swapped us as we got off the boat. And then Chesbrough, I had replaced him as exec officer. So the two guys I replaced both got killed the same day. A few days after that, on the 20th, again over around Joaquin, an infantry company got hit hard. And virtually overrun. In fact, within the first 5 minutes, the only officer left alive in the company and functioning was our forward observer, Howard Ridgway, who took command of the company and ended up earning the Silver Star. A little interesting side note on Howard, he was wounded at the same time the company commander was killed. A round hit in the command post, and he received some private wounds to the stomach. When they finally medevaced him out to the hospital, they did a preparatory surgery to determine how severely he was wounded. And what they found out was that there had been no penetration of the abdominal wall. So he probably would have been over the wound in a couple of weeks, but it took him 6 weeks to recover from the preparatory surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But Howard got Silver Star. Chesbrough got Silver Star. And then we got... later on that spring, we lost Ray Ficklin. Well, and when Howard Ridgway was wounded, his recon sergeant was killed. John Cushman was killed. Just a few weeks later, in May, we lost David Gray and Ray Ficklin, both forward observers. I don't know if we've ever calculated, been able to figure out how many casualties we had. Within the battery area, we were getting hit routinely with small arm fire and rifle grenades and recoilless rifles throughout the time we were there at Binfook. They never tried to overrun the position. They would just probe the perimeter or sit off the side and shoot at us. But we had a large number of casualties. More so, I think, than the other batteries. And then, of course, in November, after I had left the battalion, C battery and D battery were down in a place called the Old French Fort down in the Delta when they got hit by a reinforced regiment of either a hardcore VC or NVA, I'm not sure which. And that was when Sammy Davis won the Medal of Honor. So, but we went through that spring and summer generally. A lot of heavy engagements. We would go down to Kai Lai area and get into heavy battles down there. Usually they'd bring a riverine force up from the south and we'd be coming in from the north. And so then actually at the end of August, that's when I transferred to the 7th and 8th and was fire direction officer for C battery, or for B battery, I'm sorry, for B battery. And figured that I had... found my little niche because fire direction officer, you work it. I worked all night and sleep all day, and I had an assistant fire direction officer take the other shift, and I was kind of fat, dumb, and happy. And then on October 15th, B battery or C battery came under mortar attack at Ben Luck, and the exec officer took a direct hit with an 81 millimeter mortar. And I heard it on the radio, didn't think much about it. But the next day, the battalion commander was replacing the battery commander. I think the change had already been in effect. The new battery commander said, well, I want to be able to select my own exec. And so he took all the lieutenant files and he came across mine. He was from Texas, I was from Texas. I'd gone to A&M. But most importantly, I had 6 months experience as exec officer, so I got tapped to replace McCarty. His name was McCarty as an exec officer. Spent the rest of my tour as exec officer of C Battery. And we were down at Ben Luck, which is right down back in that same area where 3rd Brigade 9th Division was, where I'd come from. Down there for a couple of months, up until around the 1st of December, and then we moved on up up in the Dao Tiang area supporting the 25th Division for the last part of the tour. We had some interesting incidents down there. That was when we used the 175 for direct support for the infantry. Another incident we had, which we were right along, right off of Highway 4, which was the main highway from Saigon down into the Delta. And there were constantly convoys being run up and down the highway. And so one night, not far off our perimeter, well, close enough to our perimeter that we were receiving ricochets, there was a firefight on the highway that obviously ambushed one of these convoys. And so I could remember all the frequencies that we'd been on, so I started flipping frequencies till I found the one that had a firefight and kind of broke into this radio net to contact the convoy commander, who wasn't real happy with somebody breaking into his net. He was a little irate. And something to the effect of, we're in the middle of a firefight, get off this net. And I said, well, I've got 4 8-inch howitzers here within range if you'd like a little support. And suddenly I became his best friend. So I said, give me some coordinates, and he did, and we put one round out, and the silence was deafening. I don't know if we ever hit anybody or not, but certainly the VC decided they didn't want any part of that and left. But so from then on, and so as soon as that ended, I went back to brigade, the 3rd Brigade of the 9th Division, and just, I don't even know who was talking to, some major or somebody, and I said, I'd like to know why we weren't notified that the convoy was coming up here. And he said, there's no reason to. And I said, well, they just got ambushed, and we just bail them out, you know. You got supporting artillery, why wouldn't you notify them? So they finally, loud as hell, yeah, they ought to do that. So they started notifying us when they were going to run convoys, and then on with it, lay at least one gun on the convoy route. But it was just, it was some of those kinds of things that people just never thought about. And part of it was, we hadn't been there that long, and I don't think they really thought about us being there. And the infantry, it really should have been more the artillery battalion coordinated that, or the liaison officer there.
Yes.
So, but anyway, we got that worked out.
Now, your whole time in Vietnam, was your battery or were your batteries never actually targeted by a main force attack by Viet Cong or Pavan units?
No.
What kind of security did you have out in terms of protecting your batteries?
Well, that really just kind of depended. When we were in the fire base at Binh Phuc, obviously we had a battalion of infantry in the same fire base with us, and they provided security. Now, granted, at least a couple of those companies were usually out in the field, but we still had a substantial infantry presence there. Usually when we would go to the field, we would be provided generally with a platoon of infantry to provide perimeter security. And then in addition to that, we would provide our own perimeter security. But there were occasions. One incident I remember in particular, I took two, in fact, again, I've got some pictures of it. I took a couple of guns and had to go up to Ben Luck. And this was before the fire base had gone into Ben Luck. And there was a small American compound there which had virtually no security that I could see. And we pulled into that fire base, set up our two guns, and all I had was a rudimentary fire direction center and two gun crews. So we had virtually had no security other than what we could have provided direct fire with 105s. So there were times where we were not that secure, and it was just probably dumb luck that we didn't get a major attack. We always carried beehive with us. I think the standard load of beehive was maybe 2 or 3 rounds per gun. I think I managed to scrounge up 15 or 20. So we always had beehive with us, with 105s. Now, with the 8-inch 175, you didn't have that. What we did, we would keep a bucket, a couple of buckets full of nuts, bolts, anything else we could find, figuring that worst came to worst, we'd pour them down the muzzle and shoot those out. Never had to do that. Don't know if it ever would work, but at least it made noise. But
and what would you have used as a round to push all that out? Just a standard.
Well, anything above a 105,
mm-hmm.
the powder comes completely separate from the projectile.
Oh, gotcha.
So you just shove the powder bag in there. You put the powder bag in there and shoot it out, and you got a 30-foot flame going out if you don't have a projectile in there.
Okay.
So, yeah.
It's like a Navy gun in that respect.
Exactly, yeah. We were just going to pour that down, put a powder bag in there, pour this stuff down, and let her go and see what happens. The Ben Luck, for example. The whole time we were at that fire base at Ben Luck, the only security he had was what we provided ourselves. We did have a couple of quad 50s there to help us.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the security was provided by the battery itself. We had no additional security. So it just really, like I say, it really depended upon where you were and what you had. And unfortunately, as they found out in the what they call the cudgel fight, which was won in November, they had infantry out, but the infantry that was providing the security had been out in the field for 2 or 3 days. When they came back, their concept was, hey, we're back here, we're relieved. The infantry on security actually went to sleep in the foxholes, got their throats cut, and they walked right through them. In fact, the reason Sammy Davis won, the primary reason he won the Medal of Honor, was that he, unable to swim, paddled a rubber raft, an air mattress, back and forth across this canal 3 or 4 times, bringing wounded infantrymen back across to safety under fire. So just because you've got infantry out there doesn't necessarily mean that you're particularly secure. And there were times we got very nervous, because one of the Kylay fights, we were out there and we kept getting intelligence reports about large enemy movements around. So you start plotting them on a map and we're surrounded. And we had no security at that point other than what we provided ourselves. And I think at that point I was down to, I had 4 guns down there. I think the other two were back at the fire base. So oftentimes we were very vulnerable. But the artillery always is. If you go back to the Battle of the Bulge, several artillery batteries were just completely overrun by the German offensive. They had the only security they had was what they could provide.
I'm just surprised that you weren't targeted more frequently.
I think one of the reasons was that we did have Beehive. And I think that we were up against Viet Cong rather than NVA. I don't think they were able to, in most cases, mass the unit strength to take on a 105 battery. Even by itself is pretty imposing, because we not only had the howitzers with Beehives, but we had full complement of machine guns, M60 machine guns, M16s. It's not like we were totally defenseless.
No.
And I think down there in the Delta, I think the logistics of the Viet Cong massing the type, the numbers to launch that kind of an attack, particularly when they're already being harassed by our own infantry out there, was probably beyond their capabilities. I think once we got down there, they were just being run ragged, just trying to keep away from the infantry and deal with our own infantry out there. So, and I think the infantry did get involved in several large scale battles down there, but they just never seemed to come after the artillery. We always kind of expected it, but they really didn't.
Now, you mentioned harassment, H&I missions, harassment and intimidation missions. I was wondering, were those missions conducted into free fire zones, or were they in suspected enemy areas, or how did those work?
Well, all I can tell you is how they worked for us. Every evening, 365 days I was over there, or whatever it was, we would get battalion would call down, or whoever we were under, if it wasn't the tag, would call down and give us our H&I fire, a list of grid coordinates and where our H&I fire targets. Usually there were probably 20 or 30 of them a night. Beyond that, it was up to us to decide when we were to fire those targets. And they would often tell us how many rounds per target. Usually it's one round or two rounds per target. But it was up to us to decide when we were to fire them. I mean, we could fire them all at one time. We could fire them once every 10 minutes or whatever. And by and large, I had no clue what we were shooting at. I assumed there was some basis of intelligence there that somebody knew more than I did, but we really didn't know. Every once in a while, I would recognize one of them as a trail junction or a road junction or something that we had fired on before. Maybe the infantry had been in contact, had a contact mission out there or something. You know, there would be areas that we're familiar with. But a lot of it was just, who knows? You know, I assumed they were getting intelligence from somewhere. The other part of it very well may have just looking on a map and saying, well, here's a trail junction, here's a road junction that would be a likely avenue for the enemy to use at night. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we're going to drop a couple of rounds on it at some point and see what happens. And likewise, feedback on effectiveness of H&I was very slim. I think one or two times we got some feedback that, yes, we had actually hit somebody. I think one time we dropped a round right in the middle of a VC, the entire VC squad, wiped them out.
Wow.
But again, it was just absolute dumb luck. But no, H&I fires, we always considered them kind of a nuisance because it was just something you did, you had to do, you did it every night, and yet you really got no feedback on it. You had no idea whether you were effective, what happened to it.
Now, what about firing into free fire zones?
Well, we didn't have what I'm not sure how you define a free fire zone.
How was it defined in Vietnam?
Well, we didn't use the term free fire zone.
You didn't?
Not that I recall. We had no fire zones.
Areas where you could not fire.
Areas where we could not fire. But if it wasn't a no fire zone, then we could fire into it.
Okay.
Now,
but you, so as an artillery unit, you never had areas that you could fire into without impunity. You always had to do those checks.
Right.
Unless it was from a forward observer that was taking fire, you could then
inform. Exactly. Right. Yeah. We never fired a round. Well, I take that back. We, as an artillery battery, we never fired a round, either the heavy artillery or 105s. We never fired a round that was not the result of somebody calling a fire mission into us.
Gotcha.
The one exception to that was on the 4th of July, 1967, we fired a 50-gun salute, as the artillery always does, except this time we fired it with high explosives, and we picked the target. But we still had to get turned.
Yeah. Okay. So there was no free fire zone.
There was no free fire zone anywhere that I was located.
So why don't we why don't you discuss the incident on August 5th where you got wounded?
Okay, we were actually in the firebase at Dinh Phu, and it was rather common for us to get perimeter probes or whatever. I used to kind of jokingly refer to it as in America. The kids would go out to the drive-in movie on Saturday night in Vietnam. The VC would go shoot up the American compound. but on this particular night, it was shortly after dark, so it was relatively early in the evening. I had actually been making a check of the perimeter. In addition to all my other duties, I commanded the Battery Defense Force and was responsible for the perimeter defense of the battery. In the firebase, I was generally taken care of by the infantry, although we did provide some folks to support that. So I was kind of touring the perimeter and just checking to make sure that things were settled down. And I was on the far side of the battery from where we normally would take fire. There was a tree line off our perimeter where we would normally take fire from. And when I heard an explosion, kind of a muffled explosion that didn't really sound like incoming, which was a very unique sound to it. off to my right. So I stopped for a minute, trying to figure out what it was. And then I heard a second explosion, which was definitely incoming off to my left. So I began to run along the, we had actually a elevated wooden walkway through the battery because it was the rainy season and it was everything else was in pure mud. So we had a series of wooden sidewalks. I started running along this this wooden sidewalk, heading over to the side of the perimeter where we normally receive fire. Got about halfway there, was pretty much in the middle of the battery area, although behind the guns themselves, when there was just a blinding flash just right almost at my feet. And I felt not really pain in my leg, but I felt a blow to my leg. I knew I'd been hit. Felt a blow to my face, particularly my eyes. And so when I obviously closed my eyes at the point of the explosion, when I opened my eyes again, I couldn't see. I was blind, which caused a moment of real panic. I knew I'd been hit in the eyes. So I could feel something warm running down my face. So I put my hand up to wipe this blood from my face, and I opened my eyes again, and suddenly I could see. And at that point I realized that I hadn't been hit in the face. I actually was, or at least not by fragments. The round had landed in the mud or in a mud puddle, mm-hmm. and what it thrown mud and water into my face and in my eyes. But I had been hit in the leg. And so at that point, I moved on out to the battery perimeter to make sure that the defenses were set up. We were ready. By that time, we were already firing defensive fires and illumination flares. Got on the field phone out of one of the guns and started checking on other casualties, see what we had. Stayed out there until we got the situation stabilized the first time around. And at that point, I don't know, somebody or other finally realized I'd been hit. By that time, my pants leg was soaked with blood. So they kind of did the TV thing of grab an arm and put it around your shoulder. And I think I said something to him about, I can't walk, I'm not incapable of walking or something like that. Anyway, I went back to the, when things settled down, I went on back to the fire direction center, where we usually had the medic stationed. Mm-hmm. And I went in there. There was light in there. So I went in there and he cut my pants leg off and did an emergency banding and checked, make sure there was no arterial bleeding, did an emergency bandage, wrapped it up. About that time, the perimeter opened up again. So I went back out to the perimeter until we could get that stabilized. And so once we got it all stabilized, we had three or four other casualties besides myself. We got the casualties put together, organized and on stretchers if they needed it, and on a jeep. And the helicopter landing pad for the medevac was over on the infantry side, so we headed over there, and the medevac chopper came in, and we all got on board, flew us down to Mito, or what's called Domtam, the 3rd Brigade headquarters, to the surgical hospital down there, the successor to the MASH. They had some other term for it, but it's essentially a MASH hospital. Went in, they put me on a table and did a debriding, what's called debriding, which is cutting away the dead flesh and stuff. Did not remove the fragment because they decided it had gone in at an angle and then turned and was up against the bone. Decided that they'd do more damage by removing it than by leaving it in. So the doctor said, well, we'll keep you here for 10 days and then we'll sew it up. And I think the theory behind that was to see if it worked its way out. My first thought was I would be bored to death sitting around there for 10 days. So I said, how about just checking me out? I'll go back to my unit in battalion command, or a surgeon can sew me up in 10 days. So they kind of agreed. They weren't real happy about it, but they agreed to that. Mm-hmm. So the next morning, I got up, checked myself out of the field hospital, went over to supply and traded in my old ragged uniform for a new one. Mm-hmm. Didn't have my steel helmet, and my boots were pretty muddy still at that point. So I then went over to the airstrip, got right over to the airstrip, and called battalion to send a plane down. And they said, well, the planes are all busy, but we'll get one down there as soon as we can. So I spent basically the entire day waiting around the little shack there at the airstrip for a plane to show up. At some point, a major showed up who was in spit shine boots and starch fatigues, and I forget which branch he was with, but it was something like personnel or one of those foo-foo mm-hmm. branches. Mm-hmm. And took one look at me and proceeded to chew me out for being out of uniform and sloppily dressed, because I think I did have lieutenant's bars on. I think I had a lieutenant bar on and branch. And he was getting very irritating at the time, although admittedly, at that point, couldn't take this guy seriously. Well, about that time, the infantry battalion commander from the 5th and 60th happened to, for whatever reason, I guess he'd been down there. He was flying in to meet with the brigade commander. Anyway, he flew in and walks in about the time this major is giving me the business. And so, of course, we knew each other. So he invited the major over to have a little chat. That was the last I saw of the major. He kind of told the major how the cow would catch. But they eventually, well, it wasn't until 5 o'clock or so in the afternoon before they could finally free up 01 little bug dog up to come down and get me. So I got into it, and I'd kind of been watching, obviously I've been watching planes take off all day, I had nothing better to do. But I noticed all the planes had been taken off from about midway in the runway, and I noticed this guy, first thing I noticed is he taxis all the way to the far end of the runway. And I'm kind of wondering about that, and just about the time he turns it around and gets ready to start his takeoff run, he said, we need all the runway we can get, this thing's been a little sick today. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure I want to be here right now. But he threw that throttle forward, and we rolled, and he finally kind of wobbles that thing up into the air, and we get about 800 feet, 800, maybe 1,000 feet off the ground, and if you've ever heard the term deafening silence, when the single engine on a plane quits, it is deafening silence, and that's exactly what happened. So he called back to the tower, requested the emergency, requested to land. As he put it, the engine's a little sick up here, we'd like to put it back down. I thought, sick, thing is dead. But he dead-sticked it right back on around and put it right back down on the runway. So I then had to go back over, call the battalion up again and said, tell them to send me down another airplane and please send one that works this time. Mm-hmm. So that took about an hour, so they sent another airplane down, and by the time I got back to Tan An, which is the battalion airstrip, it was getting pretty well dark, so I just spent the night in the battalion and then went on back down to the battery the next day. And then every day I'd go over to the infantry aid station and they'd redress the wound and clean it out. And after about 10 days, I took a ride up to the battalion and got the battalion, our battalion surgeon, to sew it up, which was kind of an interesting experience. Besides, a friend of mine from college happened to be there at that point, plus several of my friends at the battalion. And so when they heard what was going to happen, this whole crowd accompanied me over to the battalion aid station. And so here I am laid out on this gurney with the battalion surgeon sewing up my leg, and there's just this whole crowd of spectators around watching this little sideshow. But that was about it. Once I got back to the battery and kind of looked, I had a number of smaller fragments all up and down my side, but nothing serious. That was kind of it. Okay.
Now, how did the other gentlemen that were injured in that same attack, how did they fare?
One of them, I know, lost an eye. Okay. He apparently had been laying on a cot between, round landing between the two of us. Mm-hmm. And he lost an eye out of it. The other one was not, I don't believe, was seriously injured. Mm-hmm. Both of them, the other two that were injured, were not really part of our battery. They were actually part of a military intelligence attachment that were there. Mm-hmm. Listening to radio, intercepting radio signals. They just happen to be located within the battery there.
Now, for the units that you served with, what was the morale like in those units, especially amongst the enlisted men?
The morale was generally very high. Certainly in the 2nd and 4th, my morale was extremely high. I'm not sure I ever served with a unit since that had the morale that the 2nd and 4th had. The 7th and 8th, once again, the morale, I think, was very high. Probably not to the level of the 2nd and 4th ones, but still had very high morale. One of the things I have observed over the years is that people's attitudes, veterans' attitudes towards the war, and when they talk about the morale of their units, a lot of that depends on when they were there. If they were there prior to the 68 Tet Offensive, usually they'll tell you they have very high morale, they have a very positive attitude towards their experience over there. They were over there, we were all over there to fight a war. Mm-hmm. Somewhere after 68 Tet Offensive, it became very obvious, I think, to everybody over there, as well as those that were still in active in the States, that we were just over there, it was just a holding action. Mm-hmm. That nobody was out to win the war anymore. It was just giving the politicians a chance to get out, as Mr. Nixon put it, peace with honor. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when morale really plummeted and where the real drug problems and other problems surfaced.
Well, and so in the units, when you were in Vietnam, there wasn't a whole lot of drug use or alcohol use? Or
I was aware of absolutely no drug use over there. And I have talked to the NCOs at the reunions, NCOs and the enlisted men that were there at the reunion. None of them were aware of any drugs. The only incident of drug use I am personally aware of over there, and I didn't find this out until one of the reunions, is one of our forward observers, who was a young lieutenant, when we arrived, the day we arrived in country, apparently some friend of his who had been there a while showed up and took him over to the Bearcat Officers Club and fed him a reefer, gave him a, mm-hmm. They smoked pot together that night. Mm-hmm. He said it was the first time he'd ever had it. He said it was the last. He said he never felt so sick in his life. And but that's the only incident of drug use I'm aware of. As far as alcohol goes, that was another interesting situation. Shortly after we got over there, shortly after I got to B Battery, as exec, we took all kinds of strange things with us from Fort Riley, not knowing what exactly we were getting into. One of the things we took were a couple of chest freezers. Now, we didn't have the electricity to run them, but they made great ice chests. Mm-hmm. And we could get regular deliveries of ice. So one of the things we did, and shortly after I got to B Battery, we took up a collection among the officers and senior NCOs, and we bought several pallets of soft drinks and beer, mm-hmm. and put in those, kept them in those freezers. And then we would basically just charge replacement costs for anybody that wanted them, so that we could keep the thing going. And it was all on the honor system. If somebody wanted a Coke or a beer, they could go up and get one. And but in the 6 months I was in that battery, we probably went through at least 4, 5, 6 times as much soft drinks as we did beer. Beer would last forever. Nobody really drank a whole lot of beer. There were a couple of exceptions. There was one sergeant that was obviously an alcoholic that started out over there as an E6, and by the time we court-martial and shipped him home, and he was a private E1. But by and large, alcohol use was very minimal. And a guy may have a beer in the evening or, you know, when he got off duty or something. I think, personally, as I recall, I had one beer when I was over there. And that was, in fact, I'm sure I only had one because my two NCOs that I worked most closely with had a big laugh over the fact that things were so screwed up that Lieutenant Strigler was actually going to drink a beer. But it was just, we were in the middle of a very frustrating situation, and I decided I was going to have a beer. Mm-hmm. But that was the, I think that was the only beer I had the whole time I was with him. So it was just alcohol and drug use during that period, at least with the units I was with. Mm-hmm. It was not, I suspect that it may have been higher with the rear echelon folks. I think it would be very difficult to have been in Vietnam and not been in a combat unit. Because even in our unit, there were times where things got very boring. I mean, nothing going on, but you're just pumping out H&I fires. It can get pretty boring. So I can just imagine if all you're doing is an ammunition supply at one of the big base camps or something along that line, it could be a very boring year to be spent over there, and I can understand why they might drink too much, or they could maybe resort to drugs. I think that's probably more than the situation than in the line units where they were actually combat.
Okay. Now, what other discipline problems did you have? You mentioned this one NCO that eventually was busted down a private and shipped out. What was the biggest discipline problem you had with your soldiers in Vietnam?
Actually, we had very few discipline problems. We had that one. The only other significant discipline problem we had is we had a a private, I guess he was. I don't think he ever made E4. Private first class. That was probably, I won't say he was, I doubt that he was actually retarded, although his IQ wasn't all that high. If the term dull normal is appropriate, that's probably what you would use. Mm-hmm. Did not have much of an education and just didn't seem to get it. I caught him sleeping on guard duty one night, and we took, well, some minor discipline, I think, just basically chewed him out. Mm-hmm. He was caught sleeping on guard duty two or three other times, finally got to the point where we court-martialed him, and actually he spent 6 months in the Brea, or the we'll call Long Beach Jail, for dereliction of duty. And of course, I thought that we were rid of him, but as soon as he got out, he came right back to us. Fortunately, that was just about the time I was leaving, so it wasn't my problem. But that was the only other incident of any serious disciplinary problems or conduct problems we had. They were the minor things. I mean, I can go through my orders and I can find where some Spec 4 gets an Article 15 for $15 or $20 or something like that for, you know, dereliction of duty, which probably means being late with the morning report or some such thing as that. So, but there were no significant disciplinary problems that I was aware of other than those two incidents.
Why was the NCO demoted?
Well, it was maybe being drunk on duty, basically.
Oh, okay,
that's right. Drunkenness. Oh, yeah, public drunkenness. Okay. Well, the last time, I think the last time before they actually court-martialed him, he was inside an empty ammunition crate trying to make a phone call.
Okay.
it was to that level of problem.
Wow. Okay. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about with regard to what you did in-country in Vietnam?
Well, trying to think. Probably not. I think we pretty well covered the waterfront.
Okay.
As far as the oral interview, I think I've got a bunch of papers here that you may want to go through and see. Some I brought made copies for you. Some, if you want copies, you'll need to copy them here because I don't want to make copies.
Mm-hmm.
I've got we can go through some of these pictures and see what you want.
Okay.
Other than that, but no, I think pretty well covered the waterfront.
Okay. Well, when you left Vietnam, how were you received when you arrived in country? Where did you come in through? And
we flew from Saigon, I guess, Tonsonet Air Base, I think, when we flew that up. Flew to Guam, refueled. Flew to Hawaii, refueled. Flew to San Francisco. As soon as I got to San Francisco, and we got there about midnight, or maybe a little before, I was able to get a ticket. At that time, my fiance was in Kansas, going to school in Kansas, so I got a plane ticket from San Francisco to Kansas City, well, west of Wichita, and flew straight back to Kansas and spent some time with her and her family, and then we both went down and spent time with my family. And from there, I took a couple of months, a couple of weeks leave. I don't think I took more than 2 weeks leave. From there, I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and reported in for duty as an instructor in the artillery school. So, and was then on active duty for another 2 years, a little over 2 years. So from that standpoint, I think my experience with returning home was a lot different than the average soldier over there, because first of all, I had family support. My family had a tradition of service in the military. My brother had just gotten off active duty while I was in Vietnam. And then I went right into a community where we all had the same shared experience. I was an artillery officer as part of a team of artillery officers instructing other artillery officers in artillery. So for the next 18 months I served at Fort Sill as an instructor in the artillery school, and that's a built-in community all into itself. So it really wasn't until I got back from Korea in January of 70 and went off active duty that I actually got back into the, if you want to call it, the real world of U.S. society. Well, by that time, I'd been back long enough and exposed to it enough that I didn't have the problems at that point that I think a lot of the guys did with coming home to, you know, an expectation of what homecoming was going to be like, and that wasn't met.
Okay. When you were at Fort Sill teaching,
yes,
were you able? Was the course of instruction flexible enough that you could incorporate the lessons you had learned personally in Vietnam?
Yes.
Into your course of instruction for this.
In fact, we were encouraged to do that to the extent that we had to get approval.
Okay.
But you know, you couldn't just go tell war stories.
No,
But
practical lessons.
In fact, to the extent that I actually was given the privilege or ordered, however you want to put it, of putting together a class which was really a slideshow and tell class designed to do exactly that, not to the second lieutenants that we normally taught, because my group normally taught to ROTC second lieutenants.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a group of officers who would come back for a two-week orientation course prior to going to Vietnam, and they were everything from captains up to full colonels.
Wow.
And I put together a slideshow, a two-hour slideshow, which did exactly that. You know, don't forget what all you've learned, right, but here's how you got to do it in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And it went over very well. It was very well received. The more amusing side of it was we would be teaching to these second lieutenants.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be teaching them, and by the time I got back, we were teaching Vietnam tactics. We were teaching, you know, here's how you should be doing it in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And invariably, there was one in every class who would raise his hand on some issue and say, well, my brother's, sister's, cousin's, wife's, uncle's, nephew was over there, and that's not the way they did it, type of thing, you know. And it just, you had to deal with it somewhat tactfully, but I just, you know, my solution was, well, not everybody over there did it right.
Mm-hmm.
And let it go at that. You know, let them make out of what they will. But, by the time I was back from Vietnam, Fort Sill at least had really turned itself around, and not so much turned itself around, but it's been able to make the adjustment that it used. The resources that were available of the officers returning to it during the year I was over there to put together a very good training program for the directed to Vietnam, because basically that's anybody that came through there, that's where they were going.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you recall any specific aspects or lessons that you took away from Vietnam that you incorporated into that? Or?
One of the things that we did, I think more so than many artillery units over there, was the splitting of the battery. And that means you've got to, first of all, you're already operating as a battery fire direction center, as a battalion fire direction center, which was never designed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you've got to split that, and you've got to split your gun crews, and so it took some learning to figure out how to do that effectively and be able to maintain the fire support you needed to do. Mm-hmm. Ammunition control was another thing. Every morning before breakfast, we'd have to send in an ammunition report. And it took me a while to learn that no matter how much you tried, you could never keep track of all your ammunition. It finally got to the point, it got to be a joke. we would, at a couple, three times, I would take two NCOs and myself, and we'd each get a different color grease pencil. And we would physically go through and mark and count every round in the battery. And we'd all three come up with different answers. So, what I finally figured out was that I really sandbagged ammunition. Any way I could get ammunition, I got it in. So I was carrying, I think the basic load was maybe a couple thousand rounds, and I never had less than 4,000 or 5,000 on hand. My theory was that if battalion thought I was out of ammunition by their records, and I was still able to keep shooting, they weren't going to say anything. But if I'm out of ammunition and they say I'm supposed to have 1,000 rounds on hand, I'm in deep trouble. So I just, by hook or crook, sandbagged ammunition any way I could, so we always had more ammunition on hand than the battalion ever thought we should have. Mm-hmm. The whole concept of convoys, when I was over there, about the time I went over there was when the press started with the daytime belongs to the Americans, but the night belongs to the D.C. Well, our division commander decided that wasn't going to be true in the 9th Division area, so he ordered that all convoys be conducted at night. So we did a lot of night movements. In fact, if I could back up and bring up another story.
Absolutely.
I was explaining earlier that this infantry battalion commander with the 5th and 60th decided we were his artillery. It finally came to a head on one of these Operation Concordia movements. He was to go down there and was told again that artillery would be, support would be provided, that his B battery was not going on this operation. And he bowed his neck and he said, no, my artillery is going down there. And the brigade commander got to a real head-knocking contest between our battalion commander, the 5th and 60th battalion commander, and the brigade commander. To the point that finally the brigade commander said, I don't really care, but I'm not sending down the trucks, because we didn't have room for our prime movers, our trucks, in the firebase. They were all kept at battalion. Mm-hmm. The brigade commander says, I don't care whether they go or not, but I'm not sending down the trucks, so if you can figure out a way to get them there, you can take your own battery. Well, apparently he forgot this was a mechanized infantry battalion. So we loaded up the 105s behind the APCs, and we went right down the road. And that was the first time we did that. From then on, we did that very often, rather than bring trucks down to move the artillery, move our howitzers, we just hook up behind the infantry and go right along with them. But that, he felt that strongly about it, that he was willing to expend resources to drag us down to wherever he wanted to go. Mm-hmm. So we were definitely his artillery. He didn't trust anybody else.
How would he carry the ammunition when you would load the howitzers behind a 113?
We'd load the ammunition inside the 113s. Nobody rode inside them anyway. Everybody rode on top.
Yeah.
Because if you rode inside, you hit a mine, you went up against the top and were killed, so you rode on top to get blown off.
Okay.
So everybody rode on top of them anyway, so we'd load the ammunition into them. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't have quite enough, then once we were down, the battalion had to resupply us by helicopter.
Okay.
In fact, this one fight where I was saying we fired 4,000 rounds in less than 48 hours, we were actually running out of ammunition in the middle of the night, and 2 o'clock in the morning, the battalion had to resupply us by air, which didn't make the helicopter pilots too happy, but they did it anyway.
Then you mentioned the mines, the track at a mine that want to be on top. Did that happen very often?
Oh, yes. Very common. Yeah. The road between Binfook and Tanan was about 7-8 miles long. Mm-hmm. And we called it Thunder Road because we would lose vehicles on it usually at least 1 week, whether it's an APC or a deuce and a half truck or whatever. One incident, we were, I was going just in my Jeep up the road. And it's surprising that we would run that road unescorted, just myself and my driver, or we just, but the one vehicle they never hit was a truck hauling water trailer. They, for whatever reason, they never bothered the water trailer.
Wow.
And every day we'd send a truck up with a water trailer to fill up with water at battalion and bring it back, and they never bothered that one. But one day, I was going up to battalion for some reason, I forget which, and I had my driver and I were just by ourselves in this Jeep running along. And it's just a one-lane road. I mean, there's no place to go. And all of a sudden, from the tree line, just off the edge of the road, here comes a line of tracers from a machine gun right across the hood of the Jeep. And the drive, my driver hits the brakes, which, of course, was not the right thing to do. And I, in a not-too-polite fashion, told him so. But that was it. I mean, it was one burst of machine gun fire right across the hood of the Jeep, and we kept on going. But yeah, there was an incident about halfway up that road that a track got blown up with mine. Of course, those tracks were magnesium hull, so if they got hot enough, they'd burn. Mm-hmm. And with diesel fuel, this one caught fire, and there was at least one guy. GI trapped in it, nobody could get to it. So that, but yes, mines were, in fact, I remember consciously thinking over there that one of the happiest days of my life is when I get back to the States and drive down a highway without being afraid somebody's going to blow me up as I do it.
Well, so what was the most important thing you took away from the Vietnam War for yourself personally?
I think just the fact that despite the fact that we were not successful in what we did, we at least tried to go over there and defend somebody else's freedom. I guess I've always felt that the freedom we have in this country, we have because somebody was willing to lay down their life to win it for us and keep it for us. And while that wasn't something I was called to do, I owed somebody something. And by going over and trying to help the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, keep their freedom, maybe I paid a little bit of that debt.
Anything else that you want to talk about regarding your experiences?
No, I think we've pretty well covered the waterfront. Can't think of anything else now.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Really appreciate you taking the time for this. This ends the interview with Tom Striegler.